explained in terms that our viewers at home will understand how, for instance, a person or persons could travel from time past to time future, or indeed vice versa.
Mr. Bonds, I think that time can only be fully understood by an observer with the godlike gift of infinite regression.
Could you explain infinite regression for us?
Roll the film.
I'd be more than happy to. As a matter of fact, I came prepared to do just that. Now, here's a painting of a landscape. Now, the artist who painted that picture says something is missing. What is it?
It is I myself who was part of the landscape I painted. So he mentally takes a step backward, or regresses, and paints a picture of the artist painting a picture of the landscape. But still something is missing, and that something is still his real self painting the second picture. So he regresses further and paints a third, a picture of the artist painting a picture of the artist painting a picture of the landscape. But because something is still missing, he paints a fourth and a fifth, until he paints a picture of the artist painting 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 a landscape.
So infinite regression then is...
It is the moment when our artist has regressed to the point of infinity and himself becomes part of the landscape he painted and is both the observer and the observed.
Well, now, in that peculiar condition, what would he be observing if he were observing, let's say, time?
He would perceive, Mr. Bonds, that time is like a freeway with an infinite number of lanes, all leading from the past into the future, however, not into the same future. A driver in lane A may crash while a driver in lane B survives. It follows that a driver, by changing lanes, can change his future.
Okay, we are plugged in and ready to go. It's Saturday the 23rd of April 2016. This podcast is available over at iTunes if folks want to grab it there, and also from our website, crazfiles.com, or C-R-A-Z-Z. Lots of links going up there, all sorts of great stories going up, and lots of podcasts to go through. Folks can also go over to Facebook. I've set up three websites over there, but the main one is the Kraz Files, if folks want to go there. And you can have a look at our new website, which is opensourcetruth.com as well, that we're doing with Dr. Rima. That's interesting, a lot of medical stuff and things if you're interested. Also go over at Twitter a little bit, post over there, but mainly on Facebook and the website. Wayne Bush is here again. He was with us last year, and we did a podcast sort of based on Wayne's website, which is trickedbythelight.com, and we did about a 2-hour show, and Wayne did a pretty incredible presentation going through all his work. And so he's here again today, and I wanted to catch up with him to see where he's at, because he's a pretty amazing researcher and always pushing the boundaries. So welcome back, Wayne. Good to have you.
Oh, thanks. Hi, Adam. Thanks for inviting me back on your show. Yeah. I've got lots of exciting new information to share with you and your listeners. So
you always do.
Of it I haven't even... Huh?
You always do. That's the thing with your stuff I like, because you're going through, I look at all this stuff as well, a lot of it, but, you will do sort of like a presentation in a couple of hours that would take most people months, even years, to go through all the different websites and get it, where you're putting a lot of heavy and dense information together.
Well, I've had a lot of help this time. I've got a research colleague named Chris Hall, and he sends me lots of material from the Sumerian tablets, the Mesopotamian literature, the Gnostics, and stuff like that. So he's an amazing researcher, and a lot of this material is from him, actually.
Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating stuff. I've been into it for a long time, all of this. And as I said, your work's really good because, you're bringing a whole lot of stuff together, I'm on your site now, and with our, I'd say after we finish today, if people didn't hear our first show, Tricked by the Light with Wayne Bush, it's up on crazfiles.com. How souls are programmed to go to the moon, sun, and death to be recycled as energy. Very interesting theories here. So we did a show based on that sort of website, and it's all on the website anyway, but it's very dense. There's a lot in there. You go into language, logos in music, movies, the sun,
yeah,
the moon,
probably,
the planets,
probably
science,
too much
religion,
which is good. It's good to have a format like this where I can kind of condense it all present it for somebody.
Exactly. If people are interested in this stuff, what happens at the point of death? We're all going to die. It's really interesting. It fascinates me. And, more and more I think every day it just seems like a game that we're living, It's just crazy. Every day I just keep thinking about it, but you're able to condense a lot of info in for folks who are interested in this stuff. But I guess we could sort of skim over your website and then start from newer material, but maybe just... talk a little bit before we start about why you started the website and just the basic principles of principles of the site, and then lead us into your newer material, because you're going to conferences and speaking to people who've had near-death experiences, and you're right in the thick of it. You're a researcher. You're out there doing it all and studying, and so it's really good to catch up with you. But start us off there and talk a bit about Tricked by the Light and why you started that, and just the basic principles there of that to get people get their appetites wet.
Well, I had a pretty normal childhood. I was raised in Catholicism, and I had to go to catechism every once or twice a month, and so. But as an average kid, I was playing basketball and listening to music, and I would cut. I wasn't super religious, but then I was at college in University of Texas. I just had all these classes. I was trying to take 4 or 5 classes at a time and trying to work 20, 30 hours a week and juggle all that. And then like you're in these labs and you're like up all night. And I mean, there's like 1 or 2 nights I didn't get any sleep whatsoever. I'm getting a couple hours sleep here and there. And you just start wondering what's the point of it all, right? And so I kind of thought, well, you know, is there really a God? And I thought, you know, there probably is. There's a lot of design that you can see out there. And then I made a mistake and I said, well, if there is a God, then what's the right religion? Which religion is the truth? And so I went and did a little research on a book that had all these different religions and I read about them. Of course, it was written by a Christian, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, Christianity sounds like, you know, there's, you had the whole calendar that was based around the life and death of Jesus, supposedly. So, you know, I became a Christian. I was a Christian for like 10 years. And then, you know, you try witnessing to people because that's what you're supposed to do. And a lot of people would bring up things like, well, you ought to read Chariots of the Gods and, you know, this, that, and the other. And I had a friend from California that came out and he was really into UFOs. And so he would drag me down to the New Age bookstore and we would go down there and he'd go off to the UFO section. And I was interested in more spiritual things. And so I would read a little about reincarnation. And then I saw these books about the near-death experience, like Saved by the Light and Embraced by the Light. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. Here's somebody who's actually had glimpses of the other side. So that kind of got me, my feet wet. And little by little, I kind of got more into the conspiracy stuff. And then, you know, John Lear went on Art Bell's show and said that the light was a trick. I guess the Whitley Strieber told him that. And so that kind of got me going down and exploring that path to see, you know, maybe, you know, is the light really a trick? And so I've been attending the local IONS group here. And IONS is International Association for Near-Death Studies. And I've been going there for about 6 months or so. They have a meeting once a month. And so I've been listening to what they have to say. And I was chatting with one of the more involved guys in the group, and he's putting together a near-death experience symposium at the end of the month. And so I had mentioned some of my material to him after one of the meetings, and he thinks it's extremely important for it to be heard. And so he wants me to present to the group, but I need to write up a lecture and have it critiqued by one of the co-founders first, since, you know, it's a little bit of an adversarial material. So I thought I'd share the gist of that talk with you and your listeners and see what you think, if you don't mind. And I know I shared a few quotes last time on the show, and I found many more interesting ones that I've developed further conclusions on. So I'll give you a synopsis of the website before I do that. So, you know, it's trickbythelight.com, and I started the site about a dozen years ago when I proposed that the Earth is a prison planet and that human souls are being farmed and harvested as energy for these multidimensional beings. So I suspect that souls are lured to the white light at death into a portal or a tunnel somewhere near the moon and are recycled again into the sun. So in case all this sounds too scary for you, just keep in mind, I also firmly believe it's all a game or entertainment for our eternal spirits, which are in the realms of the real heavens above the counterfeit light in the astral plane. So here's the basic speech I would give to IONS, and I don't necessarily expect to change anyone's mind. Most people would prefer to believe a beautiful lie over an ugly truth, but people who reject the material, I think a majority of them deep down inside question it all, and they have all these questions that can't be answered. So, you know, the success is not getting people to agree, but it's planting the seeds to cause them to question everything. You know, to be a heretic means to think for yourself, and it's really a badge of honor if you're doing it for the right reasons. So the truth will set them free, but until they decide to seek the truth, they'll be imprisoned in this false reality. Hmm. So, you know, Adam, feel free to interrupt me at any time and give me comments or ask questions. And, you know, if I just seem to be droning on and on, you know. So.
No, it's all I'd say before you start is it's very, very interesting, you know, about that death experience, because a lot of it does add up. You know, you think, God, you know, you have the initial death, the tunnel, the light, the other side of the tunnel, meeting the beings, sometimes yeah. angels, guides, friends, family, even yeah. pets, your life. You seem to have this life review, and then you get sent back to Earth with an erased mm-hmm. memory.
Exactly.
So how are you supposed to learn anything when that happens? And I mean, we had Anthony Peake on this podcast talking about the daemon and, mm-hmm. You know, deja vus, that we could be just being coming back and back and back over and over again, but not remembering. And
Memories. We don't remember why we're here, where we were before here.
You
right?
wonder why would that be? If you live this whole life to 70, 80, 90, even 100 years old, and then you pass over, and then you come back again, but you don't remember anything. So how are you supposed to sort of learn anything? But it just seems you do get that feeling that people are being recycled constantly. Yeah, for some type of being used for some type of energy. But as you said, I think it's not all negative. I think from what I'm reading now on some information, you just need to be aware of it. In the death after you have passed, after you have died, be aware of exactly who you are and what you are.
Yeah.
And, that's very interesting, I think, for anyone who's interested in the afterlife experience as to what's really going on here. So,
that's what I'm trying to discover.
Yeah. And
there's actually
really
this one guy from, I think it was Venezuela. His name is Gary. He had this experience and he saw a bunch of technological stuff on the other side. And when he went to see the movie The Matrix, he had to walk out in the middle of the movie because it reminded him so much of his experience. And then on there's this great website called nderf.org where there's like over 4,000 near-death experiences that are posted there by people. And on that, they ask a question, well, is there anything we can do? Is there anything an organization can do to help? And he said, yeah, find out what's going on.
I was thinking that yesterday, the other night, I had the most intense, deep dream, and then I was thinking about it, it was so lucid. And I thought, like he says in The Matrix, what if you had a dream that was so real that you couldn't wake up from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and this world that I'm talking to you now? And I thought, my dreams, there's no way if I couldn't wake up from that dream, I'd make it back to where I am now, and then it's almost like a coma and you think, what if you just continued to live that dream and started having dreams within that dream? Could you make it back to where we are
now?
Would this life right now have any meaning in that regard, And would you want to come back? And then you look at your life now and you say, well, why isn't it a dream? What is it really? Why couldn't it all be a simulation, for example? It's too much for people to understand, but...
We have dreams every night.
Isn't it? Yeah, you go to sleep.
That wasn't even real. That was just a dream.
Yeah, and you're like, what's this? Where am I now? What is this? Is it so hard to believe that this is a dream of another dream? Where the hell are we?
Here's the speech I would give to Ions if I'm approved to do that. And I would say,
is this a speech
you're
giving with visual, or it's just a spoken word thing?
No, it's just going to be spoken. I mean, I don't know. They may set up a PowerPoint or something. I can show some images. But it's mainly quotes from near death. I'm trying to come at it from their level, which is near death experience, and I'm not going to go into all the moon and sun and all the conspiracies. But I'm just going to, with their own quotes, I'm going to lay it out there and see if they can see what's going on. So I'd say, greetings everyone. I come to you in the spirit of love and truth, and in an effort to better understand why we're all here on this blue green marble we call Earth. And I'd like to thank all of you for everything you've shared with me over the last 6 months, and that I've attended the meetings, and for listening and providing feedback. And just to give you a little background on how this came about, I was asked to share some of my findings after investigating probably what amounts to a half of the over 4,000 near-death experiences that are posted on the nderf.org website, which was started by researchers Jeff and Jody Long. And I'd like to clarify that I myself have not had a near-death experience, but I think a lot can be gleaned from comparing the commonalities and the differences among the entire body of evidence. I don't pretend to know the truth, but when you read dozens and dozens of accounts, one after the other, patterns form and the overall bigger picture begins to emerge. It's not my intent to prove anything to you or discount your personal experiences that hold deep meanings and sacred spiritual truths for you, but just to point out some honest questions that might help us all to perhaps better understand what's going on. And I sincerely believe that what all near-death experiencers experienced really happened, and that they believe it and know it to be real. In most areas of life, it is by exploring and studying the outliers of a phenomenon that deeper truths can be uncovered. Let's get to the data. I've noticed some commonalities among the experiences and have categorized them. And all the quotes I give are from the NDERF.org website, unless stated otherwise. I have two or three dozen quotes for each section, but obviously in the interest of time, I'll only share a few here. So some of what I'm going to cover might be a little disconcerting, but the first observation I'd like to make should be kept in mind throughout, and that is over two dozen people came back and said they got the distinct impression that life is like a game, a drama, or a play, which actually makes a lot of sense if we are perfect eternal souls or spirits. You know, there's the oft-used axiom, as above, so below, which implies this is but a microcosm of the macrocosm. And there's also the spiritual quote of God saying, let us make man in our image and our likeness. So on here, we love our entertainment, whether it's the big ball game, a Hollywood movie, or a rock concert. So, you know, perhaps that can give us some insight as to why we're here. So Monty, these are all near-death experience quotes. Monty said, in reality, I do remember the feeling that life was sort of like a game, maybe even a game I had chosen a role to play in. And David J. said, I asked him what the meaning of life is. He told me, quote, for the entertainment of the spirit realm. Dwayne S. said, I was also reminded that the reason we leave the celestial realm at all was for the excitement, variety, adventure, and entertainment that different incarnations offer. As one entity jokingly remarked, if the internal divine part of us grows tired of singing and playing harps, there are thousands of other universes created for our spiritual growth, amusement, and entertainment. Eternity is a long time to do nothing but play harps. And Rusty S. said, life as a human is more like a dream. Role in a play, virtual reality game, character in a drama, and though these words fall far short of actual explanation. Nancy D. said, at this time I had an overwhelming feeling of completion, like I had accomplished some great feat or game. I was feeling, you did it, you won, you beat the game, end quote. Another theme which ties into the first is that some experiencers report that the world is holographic or even a simulation, much like the holodeck on Star Trek. Brian T. said, I now believe this is an illusion, a simulation, a virtual reality. Sure, it's as real as we think it is, right down to the constituents of atoms and laws of physics. It's amazing. But the picture on our TV seems real. We just understand how the pixels come to be there. Jack C. said it was like a computer game running in the background. Stanley S. said, we live in an illusion of this earthly life inside our bodies while our spirits, our souls, are trapped within us. End quote. A logical place to start with is the soul and how it's described. The most common description is that it's made of light. It's translucent, a liquid light, or a luminous egg. And after death, the frequency of our soul rises. So in going to the light, many near-death experiencers report being drawn to the light like a magnet and uses phrases like, I found myself going through a tunnel toward a light. Now, what I think happening is that most find the light attractive and go there by choice, whether consciously or subconsciously, but there's an element of being pulled once they desire to go to the light. And, you know, Adam, you're going to see as I go through this that near-death experiences are not even in control of the experience. I mean, they're just kind of pulled around from here to there and told what to do. But
these guides we hear, mm-hmm. Wayne, you know, like at the point of death when people see their loved ones and they're often met by these guides who take them into this light and then they have a life review and then convince them to go back to the earth plane. These beings, are they necessarily bad in any way, or these actual beings on the other side?
You can draw your own conclusions. I've drawn mine. I think that most of them are posing. They're basically archons that are, they can, as well, I'll show later, they can take any form they want. They can shape shift, and it's a little deceptive. But so Douglas H. said, then I became aware of something like a tunnel, and I remember feeling drawn toward it. Nam A. said, I saw a dark tunnel and began to travel out of the top of my head and through it. Danielle V. said, at the same moment of maybe 1 second later, I felt myself leaving my body. I found I was in a tube and was being sucked toward the light. It was a very liberating feeling. I went further because I wanted to go to the light. Bonnie C. said, seemed to turn away and very quickly was sucked into a small, tight tunnel. It was dark and I could see a small pinprick of light at the end. I moved through the tunnel for what seemed a long time. End quote. So now we can get to the tunnel and vortex, which you were referring to. And there's predominantly two tunnels reported. One arches upward toward the light and the other one downward towards a darker, less pleasant experience. So some of the common traits associated with the tunnel are vibration, color, music, wind, magnetism, and electricity. There's several destinations on the other side of the light. Many talk about a garden or park, which is perhaps the park that Robert Monroe mentions in his Hemisync program. There's a river of life that souls ride on, or sometimes acts as a barrier to the other side. And there's quite often a crystal city mentioned with a dome and tower. And then there's an area which reminds souls of a waiting room in a hall where they're sometimes greeted by dead relatives and given a life review. But Matt S. said, I saw a tube projecting up at about a 45-degree angle, much like a pipe in the ground. Above it, approximately two mouth diameters away, were two very bright white lights. These lights pivoted toward a target soul ascending the tunnel and paused for a few seconds while the soul entered the light. The light would then pivot like a searchlight towards another soul and pause again while the soul entered the light. Both lights were identical and moved similarly but independently. I knew that these were souls entering the light. Got the last name on this one, but they said, I opened my eyes and saw that I was enclosed in a tube of brilliant, golden, vibrating, living light. I was so astonished, especially when I began to levitate upwards into this light tube and felt released from the physical discomfort of my sick body. There was a growing sound, a wind-like sound, which swelled into music like I had never heard. It wasn't exactly organ music, but something created by synthesizer, a blend of water and wind and flutes. Marie E. said, I also experienced fabulously rich colors and colors or hues that I've never seen in normal life. The colors were lit up and changing. There were far more colors than we see here. Moises said, I tried to come back down to my body, but I couldn't because something was pulling me upwards. The cold continued and very intense and dazzling yellow light appeared, along with a strong wind, with a loud noise of wind. I started to enter this light tunnel, and before going into it, I looked down and said to the people there that I was up above. Camila F. said, it felt like I was being dragged through a dark, wide tunnel high up and far away by some strong force like a magnetic field. Bill V. Says, it was not in human form. I was pure energy, and I was drawn to a huge white and golden light that seemed to encompass the whole universe. It began to draw me towards it, and as it did, it was like an experience of what people call the eye of the storm, a device that has a static electric field, and when you touch the glass, the static electricity is drawn to your fingers. Sheba M. said, the first thing I see is an endless field or meadow of the most beautiful flowers. I told myself, oh, this is the Garden of Eden. Jorge R. said, I instantly found myself on a pathway like in a gigantic garden, and there was light, much light, all around me. I felt a peace and tranquility I've never felt since. I was walking on the path. One could see much vegetation, plants, flowers, and trees. Julian D. said, it was a place, a domain that I knew right away was a transfer station, a place where beings go when moving between realms. It was like a city of crystal structures and verdant green trees and vegetation. I went into a huge, huge beyond comprehension, perhaps dome-like structure where one would go to meet with enormous beings of light, energy, and color to do the life review. Bonnie M. said, was then shown many wondrous things of crystal light buildings full of prisms of light as we went to another pyramid tower, and there I was shown things I'm not to speak of. Denny B. said, I was being dragged by my two personal angels, light beings, by both arms between them. I did not go through a tunnel of light, but I was immediately there. They helped me across a long white bridge. To my left, about halfway across the bridge, was a large city made of light. The colors were silver, blue, white, and silver. It looked like crystal light. I was getting better as we approached the end of the bridge and entered a large white dome at the end of the bridge. And there's an excerpt from a book on spiritism, which is on that website, and it says, high above the radiant sanctuary rose a translucent tower made of a solid, transparent substance similar to crystal. So in the light, on the nature of the light, some describe it as luminescent or fluorescent, and often the light beings are said to be glowing. So near-death experiencers describe the light as being translucent, like a liquid light, and as bright as a thousand suns, yet didn't hurt their eyes. Sean M. said, the light was a thousand times brighter than the sun, but never burned. You felt you were the only one that mattered. It was the only description is pure love. Udon T. said, the next thing I remember was seeming to become part of everything, but moving with huge fluorescent light structures that formed waves and were perfect in size and movement, and the light was perfect. There were no beings but energy like myself that was part of everything, and there was no coolness or heat or wind or anything, just perfect fluorescent lights that controlled all the structure, and gently everything moved in waves. Joe B. said, as my awareness increased, it became apparent that this white light was a knowing light. It seemed to be in love with me, amused at me, and ultimately knowledgeable of every nuance of my being. So the being in light, whom many describe as God, evokes a feeling of oneness and an indescribable, intense, immense love. Nicole Beatty said, "The most amazing part was a pure feeling of the most intense love I can barely describe. It was just wave after wave of pure love. It was within me. It was around me. It was everything. It felt like heartbeats of love, one wave of love after another." Myra S. said, "This light presence of pure, unconditional love seemed to be in me and around me, all pervasive, extending into infinity." And Lisa said, "The being of light reminded me that my purpose was to learn more about love, compassion, and how to express them on Earth, and that my work was to help." Mary W. said, "The lesson was so simple. It's all about love, how much God loves us, and how well we learn to love others and ourselves during this life on Earth," end quote. So I'd like to talk about love for a bit, since it's reported to be the core of the experience and the meaning of life, you know, to learn to love. So, you know, many say it's all about love. So now it's often claimed that in order for us to learn to love, someone has to suffer so that we can show them love and compassion. So not only is someone suffering and enduring pain, the person who needs to learn the lesson now also is suffering through empathy. Is it not possible to learn love by doing positive things like a couple making love or by spending time together in good conversation, having fun, basically saying, "I care enough about you that I want to spend my time with you"? In this speech, Pat, this is another guy at the meeting, said that love is more of a verb than a noun, and it's based on action. So shouldn't we consider what the light does and not how beautiful, powerful, all-knowing it is or how good it makes one feel? There are some horrific stories that occur here on Earth where people are abducted and tortured for years. Is that really necessary to learn love, or is there something else going on? The example of a great-looking guy seducing a woman by whispering sweet nothings and telling her how much he loves her, you know, that she falls in love with him and it makes her feel special and wonderful comes to mind. But then later she catches him cheating on her, you know, lying. And in the near-death experience cases, the soul frequently is forced to come back to Earth or gets sent back against its will in order to suffer or help others who are suffering. We are told it's wrong for us to cause suffering for another human being, right? But I guess it's okay for God to make us suffer. Suffering is not the only way to teach love. What do you think, Adam?
Yes.
But that's to say that we have to come back to learn love, and it seems that, you know, people have to suffer for in order to show that love.
Yeah, the religious teachings do that. It's all about guilt, constant guilt onto people, you know. Yeah. The Christ suffered, and, you know, you must pay for the sins. They're always doing that, especially to the young kids, the young mind. They're molding it like that, so they're growing up feeling guilty and growing up in fear, which is, again, feeding the system.
Right. So like Raymond Moody said that the two most prominent things in the near-death experience is love and knowledge. So they claim to know everything while in the light or have access to anything they want to know and also are given wisdom while there. Then why the need to return to Earth to learn? Are we to believe our souls are created as blank, empty slates that need to spend thousands of years here on Earth? Or have we somehow fallen from a state of grace and need to redeem ourselves? What's going on here? Kelly Kay said, "Along with this, I had gained universal knowledge of all things." Carol V. said, "I experienced light beings who were knowledge and gave me answers to all the questions of the universe, universal truth and knowledge." Daniel A. said, "While I was there, and only there, access was given to knowledge, everything that ever was, is, and will be." Cougar said, "They filled my head with their wisdom." Jacob B. said, "Yeah, it took a few months before I could start to allow my conscious mind to expand enough to house the wisdom that had been imparted to me." And Judith E. said, "I feel like I was given much wisdom," end quote. The other thing is the euphoria that they feel. I guess it ties in with the love, but it can be obtained here on Earth with drugs such as ecstasy. And Gene J. said, "Perhaps it was euphoric trance of some kind. It was as if a spirit had consumed my whole being." And Joe D. said, "I'm sure some sort of deal was forged that day, but instantaneously I was overcome with a euphoric feeling of what I can only describe as complete contentment." David W. said, "A feeling of liberation opposite the death, or even a feeling of invulnerability. At the time, one has the impression a little intoxicating to have won a fight against the grim reaper. Nothing else on Earth can get to you, a feeling of a light euphoria," end quote. So, you know, here on Earth, we have these drugs that can generate states of ecstasy. In fact, most people know the drug MDMA as ecstasy because of the blissful states of ecstasy and euphoria it generates. It's also earned the nickname the love drug, and a 2009 study confirmed that MDMA causes the brain to release oxytocin, which is the human hormone linked to feelings of love and compassion. And the short-term effects of it include euphoria, a sense of general well-being and happiness, increased sociability and feelings of communication being easy or simple, increased empathy or feelings of closeness with others, a sense of inner peace, a false sense of affection, and impaired judgment. Okay, so the next section, which ties into this, is the collective soul. I consider it to be a very important topic, and it's not the only, not only due to the overwhelming majority of experiencers in the light experience a sense of connectedness or oneness. I found quite a few who speak of a collective soul in which millions of souls, perhaps all, are connected in a sort of hive mind or as part of some kind of super organism. And this evokes comparison to the Borg on Star Trek, who assimilate souls into their collective, and also to certain species on Earth, such as ants, bees, schools of fish, flocks of birds. So some near-death experiencers felt like they would lose their individuality if they decided to go ahead and merge with the light. Once you are part of the collective, what if the collective decides that you should return to Earth to learn what it's like to suffer as a victim of torture? You know, do we lose our sovereignty, our free will, our very soul? Jean said, "I knew that what I found was the sum total of all knowing or wisdom of all people for all time, past, present, and future. All wisdom comes from this pool of collective knowing, and all we learn goes into the pool for the use of everyone." Ryan G. said, "This light presence of pure unconditional love seemed to be in me and around me, all pervasive, extending into infinity. I'd father the light more as a collective soul." Annie P. said, "We are a collective soul group experiencing the balancing of duality." JMH said, "I started wondering where I was and looked outside my light pod, which had no inside or outside, but for sake of description, I will say pod, and I saw others just exactly like me, in a great light pod in the center of us, of all of us, millions of us, floating in the otherwise dark void with a pure golden light connecting each of us to the center pod." Chantel L. said, "All the knowledge of the universe was inside my being. I no longer felt as a separate individual. I felt as if I was part of a collective consciousness. I sensed billions and billions of beings, and we were all one. The feeling of oneness on the other side is amazing." And Jill D. said, "What happened was that I became part of, or returned to, the presence that was so amazing. The closest analogy I can come up with is Odo in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, when he would go to his home planet and return to the collective. Only everything in the universe is part of this collective. In essence, the universe is the collective," end quote. So that brings up the merging with the light. And Gwen J. said, "What I remembered was that I had completely merged again with God. It was a void, darkness, but unconditional love. I was no longer a separate being. I was where I belonged, where I came from. It was perfect. When it was time to return, I had to again differentiate from God and become a separate soul again. Yet I was still part of God. The void was God. All is God. The void is unconditional love." And Bryce W. said, "It was revealed to me then that our prime purpose for existing was to ever progress upwards through many dimensions towards the light of the ultimate absolute reality, while always retaining our blessed uniqueness. In the end, we will all merge with all things, restore harmony to creative existence. We would then still be ourselves, but also have access to the infinite knowledge, power, and presence of the Creator God as we finally withdraw once again into ourselves." And Justin Yu said, "I was ready to start to merge with the love and light, but not fully, and seemed to for a while, the feeling of oneness and love and bliss and knowing is profound. I knew if I merged totally, I would disappear, would become one with it and all." And he didn't write it very well. Many describe the light as God and as a collective soul. But when asked or talking about who or what God is, they often talk about different descriptions. So first, I would like to read a Gnostic passage describing God, whom they call the Ineffable Father, when the term Father was used to explain to humans that cannot understand something that has no gender. So it says, quote, "He who is ineffable. No principle knew him, no authority, no subjection, nor any creature from the foundation of the world except he alone. For he is immortal and eternal, having no birth. For everyone who has birth will perish. He is unbegotten, having no beginning. For everyone who has a beginning has an end. No one rules over him. He has no name. For whoever has a name is the creation of another. He is unnameable." He has no human form, for whoever has human form is the creation of another. He has his own semblance, not like the semblance we have received and seen, but a strange semblance that surpasses all things and is better than the totalities. He looks to every side and sees itself from itself. He is infinite. He is incomprehensible. He is ever imperishable, has no likeness to anything. He is unchanging good. He is faultless. He is everlasting. He is blessed. He is unknowable while he knows himself. He is immeasurable. He is untraceable. He is perfect, having no defect. He is imperishably blessed. He is called Father of the Universe. End quote. So if God is perfect, as many claim, then why right now in the world is an innocent kid being tortured to death and a boy just becoming an orphan as his whole family is killed in front of him? I mean, how could this occur if there's a perfect God in control? Pam Reynolds was told by people on the other side that God is not the light. The light is what happens when God breathes. Leonard said, "This light loved me. This light talked to me. I asked it if it was God, and it answered me, 'Yes, I am the light.'" David said, "The light itself spoke to me, and I knew it was God, the power that created the whole universe." Amy said, "God was the mind or the order in all things, the supreme highest vibration and frequency and essence around and in everything, all that is beautiful and peaceful and one, and all that is good." Marianne F. said, "I asked her if I could speak to God. Then God came down, like on an elevator, from a higher heaven and sat down in front of me. God looked like Jesus in an all-white gown and big, about 6'5" tall." Jennifer W. said, "I was high in the sky and Jesus was there next to me. Suddenly I heard this very deep pulsating vibration. It was kind of spooky, but somehow I sensed that God was somewhere out there. I told Jesus I didn't want to stay and talk. I needed to find the source of the vibration. Jesus wouldn't let me go and explore." Tanja B. said, I guess it's Tanya, I don't know, it's got a J. "I asked the energy ball if it was God. They said, 'That is a human word, but if it makes you feel comfortable, you may call us God.'" Cricket said, "By now I was standing on the floor of the hall looking toward the far end of it. Well, God was there, or more accurately, a great fire or light that I was to understand represented or stood for God." Colleen said, "Thus I asked to meet God to decide with him what I could do to serve his cause, and she told me that God was not someone we could meet, we couldn't bear the vision, but he is an energy that we can feel and see as a light of variable intensity depending upon one's heart's purity." And Tom S. said, "I was suddenly in front of a great light, it had to have been God." And Robin said, "But people will always be limited to explaining their NDE through their human understanding of God, which is not universal, but subjective." Okay, while on the topic of God, I'd like to mention Jesus, as he is frequently seen. And some near-death experiencers say he's God, and others say he isn't. Some say he had blue eyes, others brown, others green. Some say he had brown hair, and others say white. A couple identify Jesus and God as the same identity, while others clearly thought of them as different personages. Sarah W. said, "His eyes wide with excitement and overflowing with love and joy. The bluest blue I have seen in my life. He was young and tall, dark, and the most handsomest man alive." Julie H. said, "I caught a glimpse of his eyes, which he allowed me to do. They are the most beautiful color I had ever seen. They are light brown with flecks of amber color that shines with love." Marilyn R. said, "Suddenly I felt someone pick me up in their arms, and I was surrounded by light. I looked in the smiling face of a man who said his name was Jesus, and he told me not to be frightened. He was here to take me back. He had shorter length brown hair and dark brown eyes." Sybil S. said, "I stood there, and suddenly I saw Jesus. It was quite an awesome shock to be standing in his presence. It was such awe I could not speak. My eyes were fixed upon him. His hair was white like wool and hung down to his shoulders. His skin was like brass without one wrinkle. His eyes were like flames of fire, and when he spoke, it was with great authority," end quote. And just quickly on the topic of religion, many come back believing in God, but not so much on a particular organized religion. I searched for the face of God because I wanted to know what the face of God was. And the vast majority, over 90%, said they couldn't see God's face because the light was shining too brightly. But a few of the five or so said that God had the face of a lion, which is extremely interesting because the Gnostics taught that a false God was created in error and that he became deluded and jealous when told he was not really God. And this being, who's called the Demiurge, had the face of a lion and the body of a serpent or dragon. Charles M. said, he came out backwards and noticed his countenance having what appeared to be a long robe on which you could clearly look the room and the gold belt he had on, plus looking at his face, which scared the living crap out of me. He had the face of a lion. Patricia A.R. said, I glided over to a seat next to the throne, and I was asked questions by a tall man at least 6 feet with dark caramel skin and dark brown hair. He had light brown eyes and a kind face. He looked similar to the black Indians from India. I looked at the throne, and I was light in the face of a bear, eagle, lion, and ram, all changing every second. When I looked to my right, I saw a dark brown man with a pin, with a black pinstripe suit and a red tie. His eyes were snake eyes and blinked sideways. He had rolled teeth like piranha, and he had two people with him, a woman and a man who looked similar. Others report with lion-faced beings. Jack said, back to the pearly gates. He came to me, and I said, hey, man, you got wings. He smiled at me. I asked him what was pinning me, and that was really tough. He told me not to look at it, but I did for a second. I had to turn away. He was fearsome, had a few faces, some kind of like lion, eagle, and such. My feeling was that it was the guard to the entrance of heaven. And John S. said, I sensed a presence to the rear right of me, and I could see a winged creature with dragon, lion-like face, similar to those seen in Asian art and architecture. It was flying around, coming closer to me in the void I was flowing in, floating in, end quote. On the judgment, many near-death experiencers repeatedly say there's no judgment or that we judge ourselves, but there are probably at least a dozen accounts where they were judged before a council of beings. A large portion of the others were sent back against their will, being told they are not ready yet, it's not their time, or that they have a mission to fulfill. I would think that could be construed as being judged, especially the ones who are told they're not ready yet and sent back against their will. Philip S. said, there was a royal figure who decided without my consent if I could stay with him or not. It was decided I must return back to Earth, where I currently and happily reside at, but I wish I could have had the choice to stay there. Patrice P. said, God exists. God judges us all. I've come to the conclusion after looking back at my experience that there's a heaven, a hell, and limbo. God chooses where we go. I had no choice in the matter. I was sent back. Attila P. said, belonging, I moved so that I could quickly get to the light. But before I made to the door, one of the sentinels grabbed me and held me fast. The door closed. Next, I found myself in some kind of courtroom. Before me sat an unbelievably stern, all-powerful, yet very kind judge. Kate D. said, the courtroom was elegantly laid out, its design both impressive and elegant. The judge's luminous bench towered over everything else in the room and reflected the authority of the one who presided over it. Gail A. said, then came a judgment of sorts where I was judged on the things I had done and the things I would do in my future life. This upset me as I felt it was mean to punish or judge me for things I hadn't done yet. David G. said, to my right were wooden stages like those in courtroom in the movies. When I looked up, I bet I could see three people seated there. Of these three, the first had a gray face, the second looked normal, but the third was a luminous entity. I knew it was a person, but without the form of a person. It was a light and changed shape continuously. I deduced that they were judging me. Deborah J. said, the next thing I knew, I was standing in front of a council of 13 beings with the one in the middle, twice as big as the six on the other side of them. I'll skip that. It's long. Marie W. said, behind me was a very tall angel and told me his name was Metatron. He was cloaked in a deep ruby violet. He had limbs that were more like light in color than arms and legs. Metatron was my spiritual teacher. The masters who had me as their task had to get divine permission from the Council of Seven to intervene and alter my experience when they considered that perhaps there was more they could do with me than just keep me on the other side and not allow me to return. I'm on the topic of judgment. Only about 40 or 1% of the 4,000 stories mention the word hell. That's logical to conclude that some might be more reluctant to admit or talk about going to hell due to the fear of being judged. But some were depictions of the classic hell, but it sounds like souls can leave if they only call on Jesus or go to the light. Nicholas P. said, the light told me many things which I choose not to talk of, but I was told that there is no hell. Hell is a lack of harmony. Heaven is harmony. Lorraine I., she was asked, what emotions did you experience following your experience? And she replied, hell. I thought, actually, I took that one out. I didn't plan on talking about it because I think she used it in a different context. Private Doubting said, at last, light is seen ahead. It's not the light of heaven. It is the lure of hell. And Sarah, looking back into the tunnel, I noticed there were doorways on both sides of the structure. The first doorway I peered into resembled a classic hell. A peripheral topic to hell is the subject of shadow beings, or what Christians might call demons, Muslims we call jinn, and Gnostics might call archons. There are literally thousands of stories on your ghoststories.com and shadowpeople.com of shadow beings or shadow people that people see here on Earth, and these entities seem to feed off the human energy. A near-death experiencer, George Ritchie, mentions in his book, Return from the Morrow, how during his experience he saw ghosts feeding off the auras of the living. They would hang around in bars and attach themselves to the auras of the living in order to live vicariously through them, just to catch the taste of a drag from a cigarette or the sip of a drink of alcohol. And psychologist Dr. Edith Fiore has a book, The Unquiet Dead, where she relays the accounts of clients who have spirit attachments feeding off the life force of their energy bodies. Shelley said, "The only thing I remembered from my NDE was there was two or three hooded shadows facing me. One was trying to touch me. I kept slapping at whatever he was trying to grab me with. It didn't look like a hand, but it was more like a hooded sleeve." And Ruthie said, "There was a being beside me. It took me a long time to figure out. He was hooded and had his arm around my shoulder. First, I thought he was the Grim Reaper, complete with skeleton bones and hood, but I did not know who he was at the time, and I never spoke of him for years." Mary H. said, "I said to him, I knew you were coming, so I was trying to run from you, and now look." And he, she says, the Reaper with a gray slate for a face said, "I know, Mary, it's frightening at first, but seriously, trust me, it's all good." He said, "We all have to die. Now I have to take you somewhere." And I said, "Okay, but only if he swore he was telling the truth." He said he was. I didn't really trust him, and I was frightened. There's a television show called Paranormal Witness, and it features true stories of the paranormal as told by the actual participants. They did one episode on hospital hauntings and the Angel of Death, also known as the Grim Reaper. And one hospice worker on the show said, quote, "Every nurse has a story that is unexplainable, something they've witnessed, something they've seen, something they've felt. I know that I saw the Angel of Death in front of me. I swear on a stack of Bibles, I'll take a lie detector. I know it. I know it exists. It's out there. We keep this stuff to ourselves because we're risking a lot. People aren't going to pick a hospital where people are talking about seeing all kinds of weird things happening," end quote. So now I'm coming back to Earth. At least half of the experiences say they were forced to come back against their will. And probably half of those who chose to come back were persuaded into choosing to do so after seeing images of their loved ones needing them. The light also tells them they have a mission to perform first, or even ask them to do a favor. Rena P. said, "Up to this day, I can't recall if after looking downwards, the decision to return was completely mine or forced to me by an inside voice that didn't belong." Barbara G. said, "It was like being paroled from hell and then being forced to return." Geraldine said, "It was not my choice. I was forced to go back. I did not want to. It was made by that main light source." Stephen R. said, "It wasn't until years later, after I realized what happened to me had a name, near-death experience, and that what happened to me was real, not a dream, that I remember then they said that they sent me back against my will. And I was really mad. Why did they make me come back when I wanted to stay? I felt controlled. Why did they ask me if the decision wasn't really mine? Ooh, I was so mad. Of course, now I know why. My life on Earth wasn't finished yet. I had a lot to do." Andrew P. said, "The light has played a devious trick on me. The light allowed me to expand and become one with the universe and then ran me back in my frail earthly body. At the time, it seemed like a very cruel experience to put me through. I was very angry at the light." And Francisca R. said, "Once again on the flower meadow, I said that I would love so much to stay in heaven and asked if there wouldn't possibly exist a speedier process for me. Andreas promised to let me eventually decide myself. Of course, I knew that it was a trick. He would only let me decide when it would be clear that I wanted to remain on Earth. But nevertheless, it comforted me." Soul contracts. The topic of soul contracts is a very important one, as it seems they need our consent and we have to willingly agree to a contract before coming to Earth. At death, that is, once our silver cord has been severed, our contract should no longer apply, and they will need to convince us to take on a new contract. They'll try to convince us that we need to learn more and that it's necessary. We should also terminate any contracts we currently have, as they were formed under lies and deception and thus null and void. Marie W. said, "We had to go to the council meeting. They turned to me and told me that if I would agree to take on this new contract, I had to understand that I had been dead a long time by Earth time and had already ascended. They told me I will suffer as any human woman who had my degree of traumatic death would suffer, but my healing would be greatly aided and accelerated through them if I would agree to the terms. Many discussions went around the council, the masters. Then they turned to me. Ultimately, I agreed." Rachel E. said, yes, life can only exist if there's death. Without death, there could be no life. So we enter a contract with God, and the terms and conditions include difficulties, challenges, and definite hardships. That is the experience we all signed up for. Matt S. said, we ask to be born and we enter into a contract. We come to earth with a purpose. On the other side, it is all that matters. Did we accomplish that mission or not? We are not judged by anyone, but we feel like a failure if we realize we did not accomplish the mission we incarnated for, end quote. So speaking of missions, they often say they were told to come back to earth because they had a mission that they hadn't fulfilled yet. The vast majority, maybe as much as 90% in my opinion, are never told what that mission is before they're sent back. Sometimes they're told they will know when the time is right or that they will receive help. A few believe they found out what it is while on Earth, but many don't. It seems a little dubious to me that we are sent back, often against our will, to do an undisclosed mission. Gillum B.C. said, the light told me without words that I'm still on a mission on Earth without saying what it was. Miguel R.P. said, this is when I was called and returned to the blue place in which I started, where the angel Gabriel said to me, Miguel, you have to go back. There is a mission for you to accomplish. I said to him, no, brother, I'm not going back. I'm here now, and I'm not about to move from here. I'm not leaving. He said, you have a wife and children. I replied that I did not remember them, and he made a gesture with his hand, and a seated woman appeared on a kind of white chair, praying and weeping, holding my diary in her hands. I drew near, saw her, and said to the angel, now I remember her. She is my wife. He asked me if I wanted to see my children, so he did another wave of hands and showed him his children in poor conditions. And he still didn't want to go back. The angel said, you have to go back, to which I replied, no way, now that I'm here, I'm not going back there. I said, what if next time I don't end up in this place? Better to stay for good. No point getting here if I'm going to leave. At the moment, I heard a strong, loud voice speaking in a very special way with love, affection, but with also authority, which said to me, Miguel, you must go back. I looked all around me, up, down, left, and right, but no one had spoken to me. Then I asked, who was speaking to me? And again, I heard this voice saying to me, I am the true and faithful witness. You have to go back. I said, Jesus? He answered, yes, you must go back. I said, I'm ready, Lord. Thy will be done. Pascal C. said, you can't decide yourself the time when you leave. You have to have a mission to fulfill. No way they will let you leave this world this way. You have to go back and do what you have to do. Never, did I answer. Never shall I go back, and you won't change my mind. Who are you to tell me what I have to do? What is this mission or purpose you're talking about? Just follow me, did she say insistently, but with a softness to which the most precious silk in this world does not compare. But what mission are you talking about? I don't understand anything to what you're saying. I don't want to go back there. This loneliness is too deep and agonizing. You're going to answer. Tell me what this mission is. Who are you? Who am I? A voice outmatching the meeting group instantly settled the matter. No one would have even wanted or thought of whispering or sighing. You'll understand in due time. No answer would content you. Let time act. Be strong. Don't doubt, and you will know. Answers will be given in due time. It's up to you to capture them. Nothing is given for free to the knowledge keys keeper. Marta Y. said, the little that this time remembered having understood included the following. Like all other beings, you're living in order to accomplish a mission, and you're not doing this. You must change your way of living. You're supposed to help many other beings, and you're not doing so. You have to stop eating meat, as no one who eats meat can remain here. Sylvia R. said, she told me that my mission here upon Earth was not completed, and I would have to go back, she informed me. I protested and begged to stay where she was, but to no avail. She did say I'd be allowed to stay the next time I came there. Not that I could or would stay, but she used the word allowed. Immediately after she had placed these things in my mind, I was back. And Pamela B. said, the third time I really didn't want to come back, and then my dad met me. He told me that he didn't raise a quitter and that I needed to go back, that I had a mission that most people would never be given the opportunity to be blessed with. And at the same time, on this side, I heard a man that I loved dearly tell me, please don't leave me. I heard him as plain as day. His voice was very clear. I chose to come back at that point, end quote. The sun, the light is very often compared to the sun, but it's said the light is 1,000 times brighter and doesn't hurt the eyes. And I think there's a good chance the light is really the sun on the astral plane. And before you outrightly dismiss that, consider that our bodies don't look the same on the other side. So it's probable that the sun wouldn't be recognizable as such either. And also consider that we do not have physical eyes on the other side with millions of rods and cones, but we see with the core of our being. And scientists also say our sun is indeed white. It's only because of the refraction of light as it enters our atmosphere that it changes colors to oranges, reds, and pinks as it sets. excuse me, Marta M. said, all of a sudden I looked up, I saw light. Now I don't know if it was the spiritual plane or the sun. Maria TK said, then the light came. I was thrown straight into the middle of the sun. CJ said, I began to see an intense light in front of me. Perhaps it was the sun, except it was really intense. Lynn M. said, before I actually got further out into the cosmos, I sensed going through a massive light energy. I think now it was our sun. I'm going to read a couple on the moon, too. I know I've covered some of this in the last show. Katie W. said, then all of a sudden I was rapidly sucked into what I thought was this full moon. That night the moon was a sliver, so this was the light that NDEers talk about. Ron A. said, as I took a look around, I saw a bright light. It was the moon. The sun was reflecting light off the moon's surface. We were in space, equal distance to the moon on the right side. I do not think this was heaven's final destination. I think it was a greeting area to receive us when we cross over. I'm going to get to the topic of aliens. This is a fun one. There's about 36 near-death experiences I found that mention seeing aliens. About a dozen actually mention the gray aliens that most people have heard of. And prominent near-death researcher Kenneth Ring has written about the similarity between near-death experiences and alien abduction accounts. UFO researcher Raymond Fowler has as well. One of the leading alien abduction researchers, Linda Moulton Howe, recently stated on the air that the praying mantis aliens have claimed to be in charge of our spiritual evolution. Another researcher, Professor David Jacobs, said his recent clients have started talking about a hybrid race and have started talking about how they met their, quote, new best friend. You don't know their best friend's last name or what they do for a living. He said the alien hybrids can control human thoughts and emotions. It's difficult to retrieve the true story, as under hypnosis, he and others have found the aliens embed screen memory implants as a cover story. The aliens have been theorized as being able to shapeshift and have been seen cloning our bodies and transferring souls into them. Ruth said, I was taken to special entities who looked like the usual grays, but they had lots of wrinkles on their faces. They called themselves the Council and then said they were part of a group of soul recyclers helping souls to reincarnate. John B. said, after a few seconds, I noticed a giant gray being descending at a 45-degree angle down towards me. As it got closer, it conveyed to me a feeling of love so strong that I could not only sense it but feel it too. It was the strongest feeling of emotion I've ever felt, even to this day. The light eventually surrounded us. From the epicenter of this light came the smaller being. It floated down and got into position behind me and out of sight. That's when the larger being said to me telepathically, there's nothing we can do. You have to go back. Lynn H. said, yes, I just knew how the universe worked, that God could have been an alien, that negativity belongs to the body only, as you are pure love out of your body. James N. said, I was taken to see a worm working controls of big cylinders that had every animal and peoples you could think of, and they were going down the cylinders from adults to babies, fish also. I remember seeing all kinds of fish. As I was walking towards the worm, I heard a voice say, you go back and be a better man. I was told by many the light was the creator God and the worm was an angel giving rebirth. End quote. You're still there, right? Make sure you didn't have a dropout.
I'm here.
This near-death experience is not from Mindorf.org, but was an NDE reported by a woman named Shelley. She says, 1 minute you're here and the next minute you're somewhere else. They took me to a room in the sky, and I say they because there were six of them there. They were three beings on the left, three beings on the right. They were dressed in heavy robes. They probably were 8 feet high, and I was very much aware that this was not the angel. It was not angels, and it wasn't the Mother Mary, and it wasn't Jesus. These were extraterrestrial beings. So the first thing that they told me was, we are harmony makers and chaos creators, and we're both essential to your experience. I asked why one person got one experience and another person got another experience, and they said that you will get the experience that will most bring you comfort, end quote. And this is an alien abduction account written by Raymond Fowler, where alien beings take Betty and Jason up into a bright light and imbue her with intense feelings of love. And Betty says, oh, we're running towards the light now. Oh, I can see the elders changing to a white light being, and the gray is changing into a light blue one as we're running closer to the light. Oh, I'm starting to change into a golden color light. Oh, this is beautiful. Oh, Oh, this is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Oh, there is such love. There is such peace. I'm just engulfed in light and blending into that light. Oh, it's just fantastically beautiful. It's just so much love, so much peace, and it's so wonderful. So wonderful. It's just wonderful. Oh, it is. It is. It is. Oh, this is everything, 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 end quote. Hypnotherapist Edith Fiore's book, Encounters, one of her case studies, Sherry was taken up into a craft, into a beam of light, and under hypnosis recalled, quote, "It seems like I see a flash of light. I feel this pulsating, pulling kind of sensation. It seems like there's some kind of form that seems to be mostly light. I feel kind of frightened, much taller than I am, maybe 8 feet or so. Now I'm seeing something different. Seems almost like a leathery, almost amphibian-type skin. It's kind of greenish, yellowish, and wrinkly large eyes, but they were, oh," and she grimaces. She says, "I really don't want to remember. It's pretty scary. The one thing I do see is that the eyes are very caring and loving, and I really sense that they are. They really don't want to scare, and they worry about that. The caring is really evident in the eyes. The face I saw is gone. It's more amphibian-like than anything else. I feel like there, it's like light, some kind of light that's making me calm. It's calming. It seems to be emanating from whoever's around me. There seems to be a kind of merging or forms or something. It's like seeing an aura around somebody. It's not like seeing an actual form, so the colors merge, but it's mostly like gold. It's not like I'm actually seeing anything, but I'm feeling like I'm being operated on. I just get feelings of love. It seems like they only want me to remember them as light," end quote. Raymond Fowler dedicated an entire chapter, aptly named UFOs and NDEs, in his book Watchers 2. The chapter compares Betty's UFO experience with those of near-death experiencers and includes sections on the presence of OBEs, approaching the light, greetings by a loving being, meeting robed entities, encountering beings of light, turning into light, communicating by telepathy, referring to home, encountering timelessness, wishing to remain in the light, and understanding love and raising environmental awareness. Another book which explores the connection between UFOs and NDEs is The Omega Project, Near-Death Experiences, UFO Encounters, and Mind at Large by Kenneth Ring, PhD. He writes about one of his cases, quote, "What on earth or in heaven do we have here? Is this an NDE or some kind of UFO encounter? Clearly it has elements of both. It is not the only instance in my files. Among my respondents, I found others who, in describing what purports to be an NDE, begin to talk about UFOs and aliens in the same context. Could it be that the world of the NDE and that of the UFO abductions, for all their differences, are not, after all, universes apart, but are part of the same universe? Could it be that NDEers and UFO experiencers have more in common with one another than we have heretofore suspected?" End quote. Here's this topic on shape-shifting archons. A very interesting phenomenon is that at least a half dozen or more said that the light being was able to shape-shift into any form it desires. They claim to do this in order to comfort the soul, but still could be construed on one level as deceptive in nature. Andrew C. said, "An inquiry to me as to which religious symbolic form I wanted the presence to appear in. A few options, then my image of Jesus Christ in a blue robe appeared." Robert B. said, "I saw the light approach. I was enveloped by the light, and an entity that was to prepare me for what I call my interview with the Supreme Being later in the light. This first being appeared to be the Virgin Mary. Only after asking, 'Are you truly the Virgin Mary?' it instantly manifested true identity. I was nearly paralyzed with fear until asking, 'Please, what is happening to me? What is going on here?'" Kathy B. said, "So the thoughts came into my head, 'What kind of form or shape would make you most comfortable?' 'What do you mean?' I thought back. Well, some require me to take the shape of a wise old man, others a woman, and still others an animal, all of different races, ages, sizes, or species. What about you?' I thought without hesitation, 'Human.' With that, the light began to simultaneously separate into amazing rays of colors and intensify into a more solid form. Once the light reached the stage where it looked like a human form, a rather generic-looking cookie-cutter shape like a gingerbread man, I thought, 'That's enough. I'm comfortable with this form.'" Natalie S. said, "The personalities were non-physical in essence, taking on form if they intended to do that for a particular purpose. I perceived the way they looked according to what I preferred for my purposes." Stephen C. said, I didn't mention it before, but beings on the other side take a physical form so that our conscious minds can understand. Lonnie F. said, I was spoken to immediately and made aware of a presence. After we agreed that I would see him in physical form, he appeared. I think that having me make the decision to communicate with him instead of him just appearing in front of me was more for my comfort than anything else. Hugo HSR said, they seek you as if they were a good spirit, but they are not, because when they arrive near you, they assume a shape that is frightening. Tunnel without end, and in the distance it seems to be a blue light calling you for the good, but when you accept death, it controls you through your eyes. When they are near you, the tunnel becomes a sparkling red. Kiko M. said, I examined the ditch carefully. Then as I looked on the other side of the ditch, that's when shapes started to take form. I saw these black creatures that could shapeshift from small to large and vice versa. I was aware this was not a good place to be. It was like watching a stage play, but with real demonic creatures. Robert B. said, I was told that I was there for 7 years and that each person would only see what they could understand when they came to her. Some would see her as Jesus, some their fathers or moms, every imaginable deity as well. C.S. said, I believe that they appeared to me, or I perceived them in a form that I would understand at the time, end quote. This example is not from NDERF, but is from Howard Storm's book, My Descent into Death. It says, we can appear to you in human form if you wish, or in any form you want, so you will be comfortable with us. And he says, no, you're more beautiful than anything I've ever seen, end quote. This last one is a non-NDE quote from the alienresistance.org website. It says, quote, although I never saw them as aliens, they did appear as monsters, clowns, friends, and even lovers. So when I heard about alien abductions, it wasn't hard for me to connect the dots that if they can appear as clowns, an alien isn't much different, end quote. Dr. Carla Turner wrote one of her client's friend's regressions, quote, for Al, the most important event was a vision he'd had of Jesus, whom at first he saw hanging on the cross. Al remembered feeling great pity and love for Jesus and then being astonished when the figure looked up and began to move away from the cross and toward him. The last thing he remembered was Jesus kissing him. And when the vision was over, Al felt very moved and blessed by the event. When Barbara, she's the hypnotherapist, helped him mentally return to that scene, however, Al described more details. And as the event grew clearer in his mind, he suddenly began to shake. The spasms increased until at one point, Al was jerking violently as the intense emotions surfaced. Barbara worked to calm him, and when he was able to continue, the vision he had recalled faded away, and he saw something quite different. Instead of Jesus, the image transformed into a grotesque reptilian creature forcing itself sexually upon the terrified man. All along, he had believed this experience was spiritual and positive. He had no conscious memory of the rape or deception that hid it, end quote. There's inconsistencies and tricks also among these experiences. I mentioned the ones about Jesus having different color eyes and stuff. I'll just go in and read a few. This soul was told they were the only one that could do whatever it was that needed to be done. Why me? I said. It said to me with a sad reply, you're the only one that I found strong enough to deal with this pain. You share the same feelings that I have felt, the feeling of loneliness, the feeling of being not noticed. That's why I've chosen you. From here on out, you will never forget this moment, and others will never realize the true meaning to life. Only you will understand life, and only you can hold my existence. End quote. Here's another person who said that who was told there was nothing else, no one else could do what needed to be done. I asked and I said, I'd like to stay. They said, maybe another time, but not now. You have a mission to do on the earth and you must do it. No one else can do it but you. I thought about it and I said, okay, I'll do it. My mission is basically to share my story down here on earth to tell everybody that they are loved too. Nuka Rirenda said, he told me, I want you to go back on earth. There is something I want you to do. After you will finish it, you will come back here in heaven and live here forever. I said, no, I want to stay here. He said, no, just go back. I said, no, I want to stay here, till he spoke in a cool voice and convinced me to go back on earth, end quote. Sometimes flattery is used and they're told they have a very important mission. Michael D. said, I didn't seem to fully understand what she was telling me, but I enjoyed the loving feeling she was giving me. I seemed to be decoding and understanding what she told me more as time goes by. I would try to put into words what she told me. She told me that I was very special. She told me that I had a very important task to fulfill in this life, end quote. In the Bible, 2 Corinthians, it says, quote, and no wonder for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light, The Tibetan Book of the Dead, an instruction manual on how to navigate the plains of the afterlife, says, be not fond of the dull smoke-colored light from hell. Remember the clear light, the pure, clear, white light from which everything in the universe comes, to which everything in the universe returns, the original nature of your own mind. The natural state of the universe unmanifest. Let go into the clear light. Trust it. Merge with it. It is your own true nature. It is home. End quote. Glenda G. In the said, in the far distance, he saw what looked like a small area of green fog. His spirit turned horizontal and started moving towards it until it formed into a meadow with wildflowers and small trees. He was thinking, this must be heaven, and I'm here because I tried to be good to people. But then he started moving faster until the meadow was left behind him in a blur. As he looked ahead, he saw what looked like the Grand Canyon. He began to hear a sound like the wind. This wind got louder until it sounded like high-pitched screams. One voice stood out, and he heard from below someone pleading, please, when you come, bring me a drop of water. Then he knew that he'd been tricked by Satan into thinking he was going to be in heaven. Instead, he was on his way to hell. Kyle L. said, experience was probably real. I do not know if it was real or it was just a construct of my brain to ease me into death, and it could be an illusion or a trap. R.A. said, I initially believed that during this experience I'd have been in the presence of God, but over the years I had some real struggles wondering about which being, God or Satan, had been its source. I cannot prove which one it was, but I do tend to believe that in this case it was God. I know the difficulty that people have with correct discernment when influenced by spiritual beings. Paul said, religions teach of a false God that is not the true God of the afterlife, but probably a demonic entity in itself who they pose as the true God. This is not God. This is the description of fear and darkness. God is not a demanding, bloodthirsty, bipolar control freak bent on balancing some sin balance sheet. Talk about a tormenting trap. This is spiritual enslavement that enforces one to live in an altered state of consciousness as well as a spiritual cesspool of confusion. End quote. Ross D. said, I turned up at this really bright bush garden type of place and I hadn't felt that good in my life or since next thing, and my granddad turns up and told me I had to go back. I said, no way in the world am I going back there. You've got to be joking. Then two other blokes turn up and they had sort of a talk about it. Anyway, they kept hassling me to go back. In the end, they said there was something you've got to do, but they wouldn't tell me what that was. I think they tricked me because as soon as I thought about going back, I was back. EDF said, but when I got to the tunnel, when I got to the round circle at the end of the tunnel where I would have entered into the light, I got a big surprise. Standing in a circle with legs apart and arms reaching out toward me was a very bright, multicolored figure, almost like a cartoon character and similar to the Joker on a deck of playing cards, but with a big smile that for some reason was more comforting and gentle than scary. He gently caught me in his arms and said to me, back to the womb, as he turned me around and gently tossed me back down the tunnel. End quote. Another fascinating experience was reported by Gary, which I told you about earlier, who saw lots of technology in the place he went to and that he saw the movie The Matrix. He had to get up and leave because it was so eerily reminiscent of his NDE. He writes, quote, people should be studying NDEs and finding out why we're trapped in these inferior bodies. On his forum, he was asked the question, what could a national organization with an interest in near-death experience do that would be of interest to you? He pleaded, find out what is happening. Finally, this NDE is the anomaly of all anomalies. Fred B. had a series of NDEs while using ketamine. Each time he was able to see further into the experience until he was able to see through the illusion and realized he was sitting in a moving chair and part of a cinema or theater production being cheered on, and beings were calling him a cheater for using his methods. He said, quote, I'd be in a dark holding area, usually sitting in what seemed like a tunnel-shaped cinema. There would be light at the end of the tunnel-shaped room. I would start hearing humming and feeling a loud, deep vibration all around me. The chair would then move towards the light, and the light would get closer. On my way down the corridor, there would be video images projected on each side of the wall, captured throughout my life and shown to me as the chairs moved down the corridor. Every time I've experienced this experience, the video would show the same images from one experience to the other. From what I understand while sitting on that moving chair is that the significant events in my life and earth are being shown to me as a reminder of what just happened. In the first three experiences, I wouldn't distinguish the television cinema setting nor the fact I was sitting in a room. I was too overwhelmed by these images of my life. The sound was actually really intense, as if it was injected through my brain, not produced by a speaker. After the fourth experience, I started looking around, and that's when I noticed the surroundings. After five experiences, I realized that the light was simply coming from an opening in the dark wall, leading to a longly, brightly lit spiral corridor. It was the contrast between being in the dark versus walking in a bright surrounding that made me feel overwhelmed by the light. The sixth and final phase would then happen. I'd be welcomed as a hero in the middle of a giant open-air stadium with approximately 90,000 spectators. Loud music would be playing while I was wheeled on stage. I remember then feeling totally immersed in the experience, as if my body on Earth didn't exist anymore. People that I knew on Earth, parents, friends, co-workers, would be waiting for me on stage. They'd all be happy to see me again. Giant screens would show images of my life on Earth, as if these people were also watching my progression on Earth while I was there. And then the same thing would happen. As the ketamine in my system wore down, I would feel my body dissolve and melt. In the experiences 1 through 6, I could see people in the stadium becoming horrified or sad. I would hear voices saying, "We don't know what's happening." In the 7-plus experiences, I would come back to the same dark room, but I would be wheeled down the spiral corridor. There'd be no humming or cheering. I would be sent back, down in the backstage area where people would be ushering my body in an open space. I'd hear the word "cheater" being pronounced by some of them. In the 10th experiences, I was sent to the same holding room. My parents were present, crying and saying that I shouldn't have artificially induced this transition process, that I cheated, and that this was the last time we could see each other. I would then see all the stage equipment being dismantled and was left alone. I remember seeing a newscast on a TV screen beside me where two anchors announced I was officially off my mission, that the program had been discontinued and I'd never come back to that area. There was an argument about how the rest of my Earth life would be not so bad, because when I first left for my mission, I had chosen a good and comfortable planet. My body then dissolved back. Fred goes on to write, quote, "We exist somewhere in a system where humans have a purpose to produce energy. We are connected to a matrix computer to artificially create universes within our brains and therefore produce energy to power a system. For what? I didn't get to see it. The more copies of yourself you produce within the matrix, the more energy you produce. An afterlife definitely exists. We are sent on Earth for some reason. People in this alternate universe are watching our lie on Earth as we would watch a reality television show. This mission on Earth lasts shorter than our life in the alternate universe because time is different. After multiple near-death experiences, I was able to explore deeper and deeper into the ramification of it all. I could see that we exist in many, many copies in many universes. But the origin of it all would be a great laboratory somewhere in a mountain setting where humans would be sleeping in little boxes connected to a matrix kind of system to produce energy." End quote. There was one account which was labeled as an STE, a spiritually transformative experience. And they asked, "What emotions did you feel during the experience?" And she said, "Immense love. I saw a beam of white. It came out of the sky and touched me on the shoulder. One responding to my unasked question, 'Who are you?' They said, 'God of Abraham.' My research colleague, who eats, drinks, and breathes ancient texts, strongly identified the God of the Old Testament, Yahweh, with Nergal, a Mesopotamian deity. One quick thing on reincarnation. Gandhi said, 'An eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind.' And Ruth said, 'I was taken to special entities who looked like the usual grays, but they had lots of wrinkles on their faces. They called themselves the Council and said they were part of a group called the Soul Recyclers, helping souls to reincarnate. This was by far my most profound NDE, as I could see the silver cord that attached me to my body.'" Alok B said, "This experience just continued to help me follow my Hindu beliefs of reincarnation. All is recycled: water, oxygen, nitrogen, and souls." Pamela M said, "I felt alive on so many levels and like I was about to recycle, so to speak." And Sandra J said, "I don't believe in God at all, but I do believe in an afterlife, a recycled life. This life I'm living is lived once, may get recycled, but I won't remember it. So just enjoy what you have and love those that deserve it and not to worry about the small stuff. I was afraid to tell people. Everyone I knew was religious. I was afraid they'd make fun of me, tell me I was dreaming. I know I wasn't. But when I finally told people, they listened and we discussed an alien connection and life after death. We discussed we are recycled souls that get put into earthly bodies. Maybe some female souls get put into men's bodies and vice versa, and always having that feeling they're in the wrong body." End quote. So, there's a brilliant PBS documentary, it was a Nova special by National Geographic, called Creatures of Light, where they study bioluminescent and biofluorescent creatures such as the anglerfish. And it says, quote, when threatened, certain species shoot bright flashes of light to stun and confuse their enemies. There's a lot of animals that actually can release their luminescence that way. So you can have something like a shrimp that will spew luminescence out of its mouth like a fire-breathing dragon and temporarily blind its predator while it pulses away into the darkness. But mates aren't the only creatures light attracts. Many fish use light to lure food in, as does the most notorious bioluminescent creature of all. What is that? It's so pretty. Remember that ugly angler in Finding Nemo? Good feelings gone. That lure is actually meant to attract another fish or another little shrimp that comes to gobble it up and then finds itself engulfed in this living mousetrap of needle-sharp teeth. Land critters evolved their own special ways of using light. Take the glowworm, for example. Like anglerfish of the deep, thousands of these fly larvae light up the roofs of these caves in New Zealand like the night sky to lure in a meal. The starry ceiling fools prey like flies and moths, which are attracted to the light. As they fly upwards, they get trapped by the glowworm's sticky thread-like snares. End quote. There are some science-based groups that have researched the spirit world. The best known one, of course, is Scientology, which teaches the light is an implant station. Another scientifically based organization is Spiritual Sciences Research Foundation. Some of their methodologies for accessing spiritual truths and knowledge is through EEG machines, similar to the machines used by Scientologists. And this is based on the realization that knowledge can be passed from the neurons in the brain through the nervous system, which affects muscle memory and movements. So SSRF findings on the light at the end of the tunnel that near-death experiencers see, they say, quote, the divine light in actuality is definitely seen by people who have a genuine desire for God realization. Those above a spiritual level of 50% or 60% are actually able to see divine light, either due to immense merits or very little ego. As they are above 50% or 60% spiritual level, they don't just see the light, but also finally reach the divine heavenly light. A person at a lower spiritual level, such as 40%, may see a divine light when they die if they had an intense desire for spiritual growth towards God realization. In this case, while they may see the light, they don't actually reach the reason of heaven. Those people without a genuine desire for God realization who see a light are in fact seeing the light generated by an illusion-creating subtle sorcerer called a mantric. Subtle sorcerers, due to their high spiritual strength, can create illusions of light as well as feelings of peace and happiness radiating from the light. These illusions are created by their spiritual powers and their black energy. They use this as a mechanism to lure subtle bodies into the light and trap them into slavery. Earthbound ancestors are generally of a lower spiritual level and with a lot of attachments and unfulfilled desires. This means that they ordinarily cannot see a divine light when they die. By telling them to go into the light, what one is effectively doing is telling the departed ancestor to go towards the illusion-creating subtle sorcerer. End quote. The foundation estimates that only less than 4% of the world's current population is at a spiritual level of 50% or greater, and they claim a level of 60% is needed to be liberated from the cycle of birth and death. So that means the other 96% see a light, it's from the sorcerer, in order to trap and enslave them. So, you know, just because a being has a brilliant or bright countenance doesn't mean they are spiritually advanced or have good intentions. Near-death experiences say we're all one and we're all God, and that we are a collective soul which has access to all knowledge and wisdom that we've learned while we come to Earth. And we come to Earth to learn supposedly, so we all have access to that experience. We have 7 billion souls on the planet. I mean, how many souls have there been in history? Billions and billions, if not trillions of souls. And we still haven't learned enough about love or whatever it is we're supposed to learn. Is it all just a ruse, a stick with a golden carrot on the end of it, a promise to give us hope so we keep coming back to supply their never-ending need for food or energy source? How many lives does it take a collective to learn, especially a collective that is supposed to be God? In your death experience, we're very rarely told what their mission is. Similarly, here on Earth, love is only experienced as an emotion and the result of chemicals. There's a difference between what we think of as romantic love and that which describes empathy, compassion, kindness, and mercy. Unfortunately, we can only perceive what the bodies were designed and given to us, so it may be impossible to know the answers for sure. But is the sense of euphoria that is felt partly due to the exhilaration and freedom of shedding these heavy bodies burdened by pain? Also, near-death experiencers claim they know everything or have access to all knowledge while in the light, yet say we are here on Earth to learn. Why would we need to come to Earth to learn if knowledge is so readily available there? Besides, almost all are pulled to the light or seem to go there automatically. Many do not want to come back, but are sent back against their will. That doesn't sound so loving to me, making somebody do something against their own free will. That is something to keep in mind while contemplating what move to make upon death. Actually, you might want to make your move and engage your exit strategy or escape plan immediately upon leaving the body at death and not wait around for the light to appear. How much is your soul worth to you? It's priceless, right? If you had a priceless item, would you give it to the first person that shows up in a fancy suit without checking their background? The most priceless thing that exists is your own existence. And would you give it over to the first light being you see, knowing it is God? So that's pretty much the speech I plan on giving, or the main gist of it.
Awesome.
Pretty,
Awesome. Lots of stuff in there.
Is it too heavy-handed?
No, it's very good. It's very good. It's just listening through and taking notes and stuff like that. You say a lot of interesting things in there. What's really interesting about all this is the, you know, when you earlier noted, and just then again, when people go into this afterlife experience and are confronted with these different types of entities, seemingly you're trying to, from what you're talking about, to convince them to go back to the earth plane. And you noted some people in experiences saying, no way, I don't want to go back, but sort of being stubborn about it. But then they would hear other voices, and then someone would say that they're God and all this, and then they would be trying to convince them.
It's like it would try option number one. If that doesn't work, I'll go with this, you know, strategy.
Yeah, you're sort of saying,
okay, well, send them. Yeah.
You're sort of saying against their will. Right, being sent back against their will, but you're wondering, do they need your consent? If you just stood your ground and continually said, "I'm not going and I'm not giving consent,"
there might be a form of hypnosis involved, like the one said about the eyes, that where they could just kind of. And here's the thing: if we did sign a contract saying, "Okay, I'm going to come down and do this or that," technically our death is not over yet. We still got the silver cord, and they may literally, you know, just send you back because you made the contract. I mean, I don't know. It's just something I'm trying to figure out.
Seems like a consensual thing. That you would have to consent to what they're saying, and they would try lots of different tricks, even appearing as relatives and stuff like that. I wonder as well if we're looking at a sort of technology, you know, beyond what we could imagine. I mean, we're looking at a technology that's being used on us here. To convince us to go back. And another interesting thing is as well, to tie it in with this life, is you look at all the movies that we're shown from birth. You look at the science fiction movies. You look at Star Wars, for example, and Steven Spielberg movies. In particular, Star Wars, when you're little, and also movies like E.T. and all that, when you grow up, you're thinking that space, for example, outside the planet, is filled with all these bizarre looking creatures, you know, and there's aliens and there's gods and there's, you know, there's Chewbacca and there's all these bizarre looking creatures. That's when I grew up, when I was little, I thought in space, all the planets are filled with really bizarre creatures when they most likely could be just like us, if anything. And you're wondering, you know, does your experience on this planet and your belief system, say if you grew up, you know, your whole life very strongly believing in grey aliens, for example, is that what you would be shown at these point-of-death experiences? You know, are they sort of showing you beings and things that you sort of believed in?
There's some that expected something, like they didn't believe in an afterlife or in God, but yet they still found themselves there. And on the point you were mentioning about the near-death experiencers, they like to say that they explain the way why the experiences are so different than that. Like, each person is told what they need to hear at that moment in time. And I kind of look at it as, well, maybe they're telling you what's more likely to manipulate you into coming back, you know. It's more from their perspective. They tell you what's most convenient for them, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It seems very much like trickery, a lot of it. Yeah, it makes you... makes you think, doesn't it? It's so strange. I was looking at a site, how to exit the reincarnation system, and they have a lot of interesting points here. and talking about the light and the spirit guides and stuff, that it could be, you know, a technology that's beyond what we can comprehend.
Yeah, and, there's a book written called Mega Brain and Mega Brain Power, I think it is, by Michael Hutchinson. And, you know, even here on Earth, they have technology that they can just point at your brain and change your thoughts, change your emotions, change your actions.
Yes.
And, you know, we have that technology here on Earth. Imagine what the aliens or advanced race of beings would have.
Yeah, exactly. Military technology.
Yes.
Yeah, it's remote neural monitoring as well.
Right.
Inducing certain feelings and stuff. I know a lot of airports even use certain smells and stuff when flights have cancelled, for example, when people may be at times of stress, they can use smells and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely that technology is being used on humans, so you're wondering. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the other thing I found interesting is the Crystal City they mentioned, and the fact that there's towers there and domes, and, like, you know, they use crystal transducers here for, like, receiving and transmitting here on Earth. And so that I found the crystal and part of it very interesting, in that, you know, and even, like, healing techniques, they use these crystal bowls, or the Tibetan monks or whatever, they use these crystal healing bowls, and, you know, they use crystals for changing your frequency, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely a connection in this afterlife experience to this world now. So the same, it's almost like the same system is also here with us as well. And it seems like they are. I would say more than anything that humans seem to be definitely kept in a fear state for most of their lives. It really does seem like that mm-hmm. we're being kept in a fear state. And then we're going into death in this fear state, and they're showing us this love and everything, and, you know, and people, of course, are going to go, my God, I've never felt such love, because they've never known such love.
You're free of your body. You've been shackled your whole life in this heavy body, and now you're free, and
you're
gonna of course, it's going to be exhilarating.
You're gonna do what they say, and, you know, that would make perfect sense.
Here on Earth we have this food chain where, you know, you don't live, you don't exist if you can't, you know, absorb or consume the energy from another being, and what keeps us alive. And of course we think we're at the top of the food chain, and there's, you know, nothing that can touch us or whatever. But, you know, we have a very limited spectrum with which we can perceive, and beyond that there could be things that are just sucking the energy right out of us, and we wouldn't even know it. And then we think after death that magically, you know, someone's going to wave their wand and we're all going to go to this heavenly place. But, you know, how do we know? It's not a continuation of the same system, you know.
Well, religious people believe that, you know, because they're religious, you know, when they die they're going to this special place. But because you're not religious, you're not going to make it there.
Well, that's a beautiful segue. How much time do we have? Okay, this is a beautiful segue into my next section, which is it pretty much shows what the God of the Old Testament, who he really is. And, you know, of course, you know, Christians and the Muslims and the Jews all agree on the Old Testament God as being their deity, right? So,
well, it's a selective sort of knowledge, isn't it, based on what they believe. You know, it makes them feel comfortable in this life that they're going to sit at God's table with him, because they have a specific religion.
And I think on the last show I mentioned how pretty much all the major religions were given to us by princes or the royal families. I mean, every single one of them, you know, Krishna, Buddha, Moses, and Jesus. I mean, and even Muhammad is related to the queen. So they're all given to us by the royal families. And Napoleon said that religion is for this, so that the poor don't murder the rich.
Yeah.
Well, he was an emperor, right? Yeah.
It keeps people in control, doesn't it? You know, millions and millions of people in perfect control. Yeah.
Yeah. So we, how far are we in time-wise?
We got some time, yep.
Okay. I want to talk about Sumer, because Sumer is important because it's the first civilization that we know of with written records, and they tell us how and why we created. So in the beginning of history, we see one geographic area where it all started, being Mesopotamia. And through time in the area of present-day Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, the most innovative peoples forged civilization. And throughout time within this area were many different kingdoms and even languages, but the culture and mythology was shared and very similar. The old oldest civilizations are generally called Sumerians. The Sumerian-speaking people were replaced by Semitic-speaking Akkadians, and later kingdoms include Babylonia, Assyria, just to name a few. And even though populations were conquered and even languages replaced, they kept the same mythology and gods, merely changing their names, but the stories stayed the same. Enki, being an easier example, was the only one primarily by two different names, one being Enki, his Sumerian name, which later became Ea. Enki and Ea are identical in every aspect, but they just changed his name. Virtually every original god in Sumerian times can be traced through history and appearing with different names, but the characters of God stays the same for the most part. So the original players of this game were Nama, and she was the mother or earth goddess. An, or Anu, was the sky father, most high of the earth gods. Enlil was the favorite son of An, god of lightning and storm. His name means lord of air, and he decides to destroy mankind with the deluge. Enki was the oldest son and half-brother of Enlil, and his name means god of earth. Enki was first known as god of fresh waters with wisdom, magic, science, and creator as his main tasks. He told humans to save themselves from the coming flood, although he was prohibited from doing so. As the oldest he has the oldest continual temple in the world in Eridu. He had his temple for 4,500 years. Ninarsag was the daughter similar to her mother, Nama. She was the midwife to the gods, and all gods were said to be raised on the milk of Ninarsag. Her symbol is the Omega symbol. And then you have Nana, was god of the moon, the son of Enlil, and Utu was the god of the sun. And Nana was the young goddess, the god of Venus, beauty, and war, and she later became Ishtar, or Isis, Venus, and many other names. Nama was the primeval goddess, and then in the beginning, the goddess Namu or Nama created the world and then was forgotten. Nama is the mother goddess. Nama or Sophia is worldwide. Before modern humans walked on Earth or were even thought of, the mother of all, the great Nama, already existed. She created life on Earth as we see it now and is known through time as the Earth Mother, Great Mother, Mother of all the gods. She then decided to create children. They were created as gods to experience the Earth. The term Anunnaki matches them perfectly as it means gods of the Earth, as they were created here and did not come from somewhere else. These gods or children of Nama grew up and started modifying the Earth. Nama, upset with their behavior, resolves to destroy them before it got worse. Her children heard this and decided to fight her. The hero varies through time, but she's then killed by her children. They take her power and use it to create the heavens. This mother goddess is known by many names throughout the world, but go by the oldest name I can find. In Paleolithic times, back to 35,000 BC, statues are found archaeologically of a very robust woman. They are often called Venus statues, but are in fact the mother goddess or Nama. These figurines have been found in Turkey as recently as 7,000 years ago. At some time around this period, she disappears, except for occasional mentioning. This is about the time the path to civilization was started. In these new civilizations, the Anunnaki declared themselves the gods of the humans, or black-headed people. In early human beliefs, they were told they were created by the gods to be their slave and do their work. The human was expected to do whatever their god wanted them to, and they were judged as whether they made their god happy. The Anunnaki did not create anything. They modified what was here and made new species, but they did not create the life on this planet. Life was seeded a long time ago on Earth, and the life evolved via the natural process that do exist, but there's manipulations and creations throughout the time, but not like the last 12,000 years. Nama told Enki, quote, "Please apply the skill deriving from your wisdom and create a substitute for the gods so that they can be freed from their toil," end quote. And after Enki, the fashioner of designs by himself, had pondered the matter, he said to his mother, Nama, "My mother, the creature you planned will really come into existence. Impose on him the work of carrying baskets. You should knead clay from the top of the Apsu. The birth goddesses will nip off the clay, and you shall bring forth the form into existence," end quote. So they hijacked the system for their desires. In Sumerian mythology, Nammu was a primeval mother goddess corresponding to Tiamat in Babylonian mythology, and later she was connected to Isis and Venus because she was the only goddess for 30,000 years. And people have done this, but Isis was a granddaughter of Nama. The onset of the Anunnaki gods caused the almost erasure of her, except in certain places. They erased her as much as they could because they killed her and enslaved her creation for their own purposes. If they allowed her cults to continue in mass, then it was potential for us to remember what happened. As long as we forget, we worshiped them and gave them our power. They tried to use propaganda against Nama, labeling her as an evil dragon. They killed her and made the heavens with her. And then you have this Babylonian creation myth called the Enuma Elish. And it says, may he shepherd the black-headed ones, his creatures, to the end of days without forgetting. Let them acclaim his ways. May he establish for his fathers the great food offerings. Their support they shall furnish, shall tend their sanctuaries. May he cause incense to be smelled, their spells. Make a likeness on earth of what he has wrought in heaven. May he order the black-headed to revere him. May the subjects ever bear in mind to speak of their God. And may they at his word pay heed to the goddess. May food offerings be borne for their gods and goddesses. Without fail, let them support their gods. Let lands, their lands, let them improve. Build their shrines. Let the black-headed wait on their gods. End quote. Now, humans were created as slaves to worship the Anunnaki gods. It says, quote, the peacemaking god Ea, king of wisdom, admonishes first Teseb's party and then Kumarbi, reminding them that all that the destruction of human worshippers means disaster for all the gods, since mortals serve and support them. Ea, king of wisdom, spoke among the gods, began to say, why are you destroying mankind? They will not give sacrifices to the gods. They will not burn cedar as incense to you. If you destroy mankind, they will no longer worship the gods. No one will offer bread or libations to you any longer. Even Teseb, Kumira's heroic king, will himself grasp the plow. Even Saska and Havot will themselves grind at the millstones, end quote. So you have Nergal, who's this Mesopotamian god of the underworld. Nergal was the son of Enlil. He was the god of war and plague. He was not very high in status early on, but at some point On helped him by giving him seven companions or weapons, otherwise known as the seven evil spirits. Nergal then planned to take over the underworld, who already had a goddess in charge. Her name was Ereshkigal. Nergal forced his way into the underworld and took the goddess by her hair and dragged her off the throne to cut her head off. In her tears, she offered to be his wife and give him the underworld, and he took the deal and let her live. Nergal now controlled the underworld and the judgment of every human who dies. And this is Nergal's takeover of the underworld from Ereshkigal. It says, quote, within the house he seized Ereshkigal by the hair, bent her down from the throne to the ground to cut off her head. She pleaded, kill me not, my brother, I will speak a word with thee. Nergal hearkened, his hands relaxed. She wept and sobbed. Thou shalt be my husband, I will be thy wife, I will give thee to seize sovereignty over the wide earth. I will set the tablet of wisdom in thy hand. Thou shalt be Lord. I will be thy lady. I will be lady. When Nergal heard her word, he seized her, kissed her, and wiped away her tears. End quote. Nergal in Akkadian mythology was the god ruling with Ereshkigal over the world of the dead. And Nergal is the god the Greeks named Hades. In the book Gods, Demons, and Symbols of Ancient Mesopotamia, on page 19, it shows a seal of Nergal, king of the underworld. But the scimitar looks a lot like a pitchfork or trident. He has the normal horned hat all the Anunna have, but this makes it seem like he has horns like the devil. Here's from some Sumerian literature, says, quote, Lord of the underworld, who acts swiftly in everything, whose terrifying anger smites the wicked, Nergal, single-handed crusher who tortures the disobedient, end quote. From the text of the tablets found at Telamana, Nergal was well known and referenced in a letter from the king of Crete to his brother, the king of Egypt. The Nergal myth is the only myth found in the Telamana tablets, and they were found in Egypt, not Mesopotamia, and date about 1300 BC. Quote, Nergal, the lion-headed god, seems here to be the same as Namtar, death or fate. His name in Akkadian may indeed mean king death, the infernal deity who usually represented with a lion or tiger head and open jaws, end quote. J.C. Greenfield wrote, an epithet to the god Nergal in Hatra inscriptions is related to his role of punishing divinity in the meaning of executioner, butcher, torturer. He's primarily keeper of the underworld and the god of pestilence. As the god of the underworld, he functioned as a judge. His lion-headed mace was able to punish and wreak vengeance, end quote. The book The Esoteric Codex, Deities of the Underworld by William Kloss says, quote, being a deity of the desert, god of fire, Nergal was sometimes called a demon and even identified with Satan, end quote. In Babylonian Magic by Michael W. Ford, he says, quote, Nergal, who is mighty and with a fiery surrounding in which you are encircled, who raises the lion mace, Nergal, who takes the form of the lion dragon, raise thy blade. To that terrifying splendor, no other god stands before. Hail to thee, Nergal. Nergal, dragon supreme, great god. I call you by the fires of Sharapu, thou burning fires of conquest, by the funeral rites to which you were called, to the shades which drink blood in your name, The Babylonian text called the shadow beings shades. May the seven tear their soul to ribbons. In this flame I curse them. Let the serpent's tongue arise. Nergal's fiery serpents shall encircle it and consume their essence. End quote. He also writes, Kuntha has an association with the underworld due to the temple of Nergal. The seven that he refers to is the evil seven, the seven demon spirits created by Anu. They are the workers of Nergal, so are always used by him to kill. They basically incite men to do their killing so they can feed off him. In the Era epic, Era is another name for Nergal. It says, after Anu had ordained destinies for all the seven, he gave those very ones to Era, warrior of the gods, saying, let them go beside you when the clamor of human habitations becomes noisome to you, and you resolve to wreak destruction, to massacre the black-headed folk and fell the livestock. Let these be your fierce weaponry. Let them go beside you. In the Bible, the Lord said unto Moses, make thee a fiery serpent and set it upon a pole, and it shall come to pass that every one's bitten when he looketh upon it and shall live. And in the Sumerian literature, Ninurta's return to Nibiru says he hung the seven-headed serpent on a shining crossbeam. Yahweh sent plagues and torments to Egypt, and the seven were plague gods. Here's the overview of the demiurge, or chief ruler, through time. And the dates of the chief rulers are a work in process and have many different sources, but Anu until approximately 3000 BC, Enlil or Bel from 3000 BC to 1800 BC, and Marduk from 1800 BC until 1200 BC, Nergal from 1200 BC until today. Nergal took over the underworld and took control of the destiny of humans. The god of Moses was Nergal. The god of Israel from that time period on was Nergal, Adad, and the Seven. And by the way, the whole story of Moses is taken from the Akkadian tale of King Sargon around 2300 BC, 1,000 years before Moses. It says, quote, Sargon, the mighty king of a god, am I. My mother was a changeling. My father I knew not. The brothers of my father loved the hills. My city is Aseparanu, which is situated on the banks of the Euphrates. My changeling mother conceived me. In secret she bore me. She set me in a basket of rushes with bitumen. She sealed my lid. She cast me into the river, which rose not over me. The river bore me up and carried me to Akai, the drawer of water. Akai, the drawer of water, lifted me out as he dipped his ewer. The Akai, the drawer of water, took me as his son and reared me. The Akai, the drawer of water, appointed me as his gardener. While I was a gardener, Ishtar granted me her love, and for 4 years I exercised kingship. The black-headed people I ruled, I governed. End quote. In the book, The Seven Great Monarchies of the Ancient Eastern World, it chronicles Nergal's move to Israel. It says, quote, the city peculiarly dedicated to Nergal was Kutha or Tagava, which is constantly called his city in the inscriptions. He was worshipped also as Tarbisa near Nineveh, but in Tagava he was said to live, and his shrine there was one of a great celebrity. Hence the men of Kuth, when transported to Samaria by the Assyrians, naturally enough made Nergal their god, carrying his worship with them into their new country. So the Kuthans are originally from Babylonia at the temple for Nergal and were moved to Samaria, the capital of Kingdom of Israel. The Kingdom of Israel was originally called Samaria. This is the Assyrian historical account of Samaria and what happened about 713 BC to the Kingdom of Israel. Quote, the inhabitants of Samaria who agreed with and plotted with the king hostile to me not to do service and not to bring tribute, and who did battle. I fought against them with the power of the great gods, my lords. I counted as spoil 27,280 people, together with their chariots and gods in which they trusted. I formed a unit with 200 of their chariots from our royal force. I settled the rest of them in the midst of Assyria. I repopulated Samaria more than before. I brought it into a people from countries conquered by my hands. I appointed my eunuch as governor over them, and I counted them as Assyrians. End quote. So let's rewind. That's the king of Assyria defeated the king of Israel, took 27,000 of the residents and dispersed them through Assyria. Then they took the Babylonians who were king, had conquered, and settled them in Israel. This means the original population of Samaria or Israel was evicted and replaced with Babylonians. These Babylonians included the major city of Nergal, which was Kutha. So even the high priest of Nergal moved to Israel and began worshiping there. A majority of the dispersed original population never return. These Samaritans have one founding holy book, the five books of Moses, or the Torah, otherwise the first five books of the Old Testament. A schism occurred within Samaria, and the kingdom of Judea broke off, and rabbinical Judaism was born, headquartered in Jerusalem. The two versions of the books have very few differences between the two, leading one to think that when the schism occurred, it was not long after the creation of the original. The oldest historical accepted date for the Torah is around 700 BC, which leads one to wonder. Also, there's no written Hebrew language before 1000 BC, so what language Moses was writing in 1300 BC? The current scholarly consensus is that Moses is a legendary figure and not a historical person. Here's a song by a group called Negator, and it's called Nergal, the Raging King. And it says, quote, God of darkness, Lord of war, grand dragon covered in entrails, fill the channels with blood, feast on the lifeblood, end quote. So in the New Testament, Jesus enters into the temple, teaching and talking to the Pharisees. And after quite a heated discussion, Jesus states that his father is not the same as their father. He says, quote, I speak that which I've seen with my father, and you do that which you've seen with your father, end quote. He also goes on to say to the Jews that their father is the devil. He says they will be just as their father, a murderer from the beginning. He states their father does not live in truth because there's no truth in them. It's in the New Testament. He clearly says the God of the Jews was not his father, and the God of the Jews was the devil, Nergal. He's in their temple telling him this stuff. And in John 8:44, he says, quote, ye are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father ye will do. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, because there's no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he's a liar and the father of it, end quote. So remember that Nergal was the lord of pestilence, war, and the underworld, that is death. Now look at how Yahweh operates. Yahweh is Nergal. Jesus was literally telling the truth in the New Testament passage. In the Old Testament, these quotes are from Jehovah or Yahweh. So he says, sacrifice unto the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. With the sword. For now I will stretch out my hand that I might smite thee and thy people with pestilence. And I will bring a sword upon you that shall avenge the quarrel of my covenant. And when ye are gathered together within your cities, I will send a pestilence among you. And ye shall be delivered into the hand of the enemy. I will smite them with the pestilence and disinherit them. And I will make of thee a greater nation and mightier than they. The Lord shall make the pestilence cleave unto thee until he have consumed thee from off the land, whether thou goest to possess it. So the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the time appointed. And I'm like halfway through it, so I'm not going to bother reading the rest, but you get the idea. He's the, you know, Nergal is the god of pestilence, and then Yahweh's sending all this pestilence in the Old Testament.
So the god of Israel is
the Gnostic.
Because that would make sense.
Yeah, and Yahweh was a state
of constant, you know, blood and fear and death.
Constant.
And brutal regime, yeah.
Constant. Yeah, so in the Gnostic text, and I want to go back to this spiritually transformative experience where she asked the beings, you know, and it was it may not have been quote-unquote a near-death experience, but she saw the light, she felt this immense love, you know, she had telepathic communication with these beings, and she asked them, are you God? And they answered, and they said, God of Abraham. So in the Gnostic texts, the Gnostic Christians were declared heretics by the mainstream church for their differing views on Jesus and their belief that this world's a prison. They were killed and their writings were destroyed until a repository of writings were discovered in a cave in Egypt in 1945, and these writings are called the Nag Hammadi Library. They describe this false god and his archons, which is a Greek word that means rulers. These archons are shadow beings created from the bile of his hate and jealousy, and they can shapeshift and appear as what we call aliens, greys, reptoids, insects, mantis types, and so on. They feed off our life force and emotions such as fear, static, frenzied excitement, and even praise and worship. And they put false ideas in our heads and create illusions and hallucinations. They can even be heard by some people as voices. Christians call them demons, Muslims call them jinn. Everyone has a counterfeit spirit that has been assigned to them, and some call these guardian angels or spirits. Guides. And there are tremendous parallels between the gods and stories of the Sumerian tablets and the Gnostic texts. For example, major characteristics in common between the Gnostic Sophia and the Sumerian Nama are both regarded as the first goddess, the mother of all gods, created the world, created things in chaos, created the gods in the midst of heaven, and all power is taken by her offspring, and her power was used to create the heavens and the veil. The Gnostics spoke of a false god, a chief ruler named Yaldabaoth, whom they called Demiurge. And as the leadership on Earth changed, the first chief ruler, Demiurge, is on, the Sky Father. And an exact matchup in flood stories between the Gnostics and Sumerian are exact, except the characters' names. The Sumerian being Enki, the benefactor and creator of humanity, and Sabaoth, the lord of the forces. And Sabaoth repented when he learned that there was a much greater god than his father, and then he was taken for protection and put in the highest heaven above, where the forces of chaos could not get to him, all because he was wise and realized they were wrong. The Gnostic talks say that Gnostic texts say that Sophia, an aeon from Source, accidentally created the Demiurge by mistake without her consort. It was not created in full and was described as a lion-faced dragon. He thought he was the only being who proclaimed himself God. Sophia realized her mistake and came down to inform the Demiurge. The Demiurge then surrounded Sophia and held her in chaos and stole her light power. In this Nag Hammadi text called On the Origin of the World, it says, quote, "At the natural structure of the immortal beings had completely developed out of the infinite, a likeness then emanated from Pistis. It is called Sophia. It exercised volition and became a product resembling the primeval light. And immediately her will manifested itself as a likeness of heaven, having an unimaginable magnitude. It was between the immortal beings and those things that came into being after them. And so she, Sophia, functioned as a veil dividing mankind from the things above," end quote. So the Demiurge's heavens are a copy of the real heavens. It says, quote, "And she established each of his offspring in conformity with its power after the pattern of the realms that are above. For by starting from the invisible world, the visible world was invented," end quote. The Demiurge's realms are a copy of the real thing. He has stolen light from Sophia, so they have light to use. The real light is from Source, and those light realms would be set up similarly. The Demiurge is a false god, and I like to spell it G-A-U-D. Dictionary.com explains that the word god, G-A-U-D, originated from the mid and late 14th century and meant, quote, "a jest, joke, prank, trick. It's also fraud, deception, trick, or an artifice," end quote. I am convinced this false god being the Demiurge is stealing the light power that is in human souls. In the Gnostic text, Pistis Sophia, it is written, quote, "She, Sophia, had been deluded through the godlike self-willed and had not been deluded through anything else save through a light power because of its resemblance to the light in which she had faith," end quote. So most likely the being of intense white light that near-death experiences go to is related to the Demiurge. Here's a quote from the Secret Book of John, another Gnostic text. It says, "Child of birth, Demiurge said to the authorities with him, 'Come, let us create a human being after the image of God,' and with the light revelation of the mysteries hidden in silence," it says, quote, "because she had unconquerable power, her thought was not unproductive. Something imperfect came out of her different in appearance from her. Because she had created it without her masculine counterpart, she gave rise to a misshapen being unlike herself. Sophia saw what her desire produced. It changed into the form of a dragon with a lion's head and eyes flashing lightning bolts. She cast him far from her, outside of the realm of the immortal beings, so that they could not see him. Sophia surrounded him with Yaldabaoth as the chief ruler. He took great power from his mother, left her, and she named him Yaldabaoth. Yaldabaoth as the chief ruler. He took great power from his mother, left her, and moved away from his birthplace. He assumed command, created realms for himself with a brilliant flame that continues to exist even now." End quote. Sophia repents and is forgiven by Source, and Source sends help to take back the light power from the Demiurge. And in the meantime, the Demiurge created the human body but cannot get it to stand. The help from Source convinces the Demiurge that he must breathe life into Adam to get him to move. And when he does, the light power goes into Adam. Thus, Adam was divine because of the light power. This light power sort of has similar overtones to the Holy Spirit. It's in every human. The Archons supposedly were produced not in full and are unable to hold the light power. It says, quote, "And what she had created became a product in the matter, like an aborted fetus, and it assumed a plastic form molded out of shadow and became an arrogant beast resembling a lion. It changed into the form of a lion-faced serpent, and its eyes were like lightning fires which flash. And when she saw, the product of her will was different, a model of a lion-faced serpent. His eyes were like flashing fires of lightning and changed in the form of a dragon with a lion's head, Self-will uniteth himself with the rulers of the 12 eons and emanateth a lion faith's power to plague Sophia, end quote. Here's a Babylonian description of shadow beings. Quote, the evil Utuku demon is tall in stature. He is shady. His shadow is very dark. Gall is always dripping from his fingernails. His tread is harmful poison. And in fact, in the Sumerians, they actually call these demons Galu. So the Gnostic text describes the shadow beings, quote, now the eternal realm of truth has no shadow outside it, for the limitless light is everywhere within it. But its exterior is shadow, which has been called by the name darkness. From it there appeared a force presiding over the darkness. And the forces that came into being subsequent to them called the shadow the limitless chaos. From it every kind of divinity sprouted up together with the entire place, so that also shadow was posterior to the first product. It was the abyss that it appeared, deriving from the aforementioned pistis. Now matter is made of the bile of the shadow. Now as for that jealousy, it was found to be an abortion without any spirit in it. So we're talking AI here, maybe. Like a shadow, it came into existence in a vast watery substance. Then the bile that had come into being out of the shadow was thrown into a part of chaos. Since that day, a watery substance has been apparent, and what sank within it flowed away, being visible in chaos, as with a woman giving birth to a child. All her superfluities flow out, just so matter came into being out of shadow and was projected apart, and it did not depart from chaos. Rather, matter was in chaos, being a part of it, end quote. Acardus Castaneda said about the parasites, he said, I did see some strange fleeting black shadow projected on the foliage of the trees. It was either a shadow going back and forth or various fleeting shadows moving side to side or straight up in the air. They looked like fat black fish to me, enormous fish. It was as if gigantic swordfish were flying in the air. I was engrossed in the sight. Then finally it scared me. It became too dark to see the foliage, but I could still see the fleeting black shadows, end quote. Now, some of these shadow creatures take the form of astral or etheric spiders, and there's also the hat man that's talked about. And the shaman told Carlos the best way to rid yourself of it is with inner silence and thought discipline. The second you feel agitation, anxiety, or anything like that, do not allow it to manifest in reality. You may feel agitated, but you don't allow it to manifest into actions onto others or yourself. The body is a container of light. Here's another quote from the Gnostic text. This is, quote, he answered and said, yes, but if you wish that he not be able to ruin our work, come, let us create a human being from the earth according to the image of our body and according to the likeness of this being to serve us, so that whenever this being sees his likeness, he may become enamored of it. Then he will no longer ruin our work, but we shall make those who are born from the light our servants through all the time of this age. Now, all this came to pass according to the forethought of Pistis, in order that humankind might appear after this likeness and condemn them on account of their fashioned bodies. And their fashioned bodies became fences for the light. After the day of rest, Sophia sent her daughter Zoe, being called Eve, as an instructor in order that she might make Adam, who had no soul, arise, so that those whom shall engender might become containers of light, end quote. A few weeks ago, I don't know if you heard this, a few weeks ago, scientists got together for the Isaac Asimov Memorial Debate, and this year the topic was, is the universe a simulation? The simulation debate gives you some big science names that support the Gnostic theories. The moderator, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's the director of the museum's Hayden Planetarium, he put the odds at 50-50 that our entire existence is a program on someone else's hard drive. He said, quote, I think the likelihood may be very high. He noted the gap between human and chimpanzee intelligence, despite the fact that we share more than 98% of our DNA. Somewhere out there could be a whole being whose intelligence is that far much greater than our own. We would be drooling, blithering idiots in their presence, he said. If that's the case, it's easy for me to imagine that everything in our lives is just a creation of some other entity for their entertainment. David Chalmers, the professor of philosophy in New York University, said, quote, and this was during the debate, he said, the way I think about it, I mean, who knows if there is actually a simulator who's actually doing any of this, but if you do take the simulation hypothesis seriously, it's got a couple of elements of a traditional God. This person could be all-knowing about our universe and could be all-powerful. The one thing which is probably missing is wisdom and benevolence. And there's laughter. He said, if there's a simulator, I refuse to worship you. You may be out there, but you have not established yourself as being worthy of worship. You notice the two things he said is missing wisdom and benevolence. And those are the two things that the near-death experiencers are told that they need to come back to learn. So it's obviously it's lacking here. Nick Bostrom in 2003 suggested that the members of an advanced civilization with enormous computing power might decide to run simulations of their ancestors. They would probably have the ability to run many, many such simulations to the point where the vast majority of minds would actually be artificial ones within such simulations rather than the original ancestral minds. So simple statistics suggest it's much more likely that we are among the simulated minds. In a larger sense, the theory suggests that the entire universe can be seen as a two-dimensional structure projected onto a cosmological horizon, or in simpler terms, a projection. So that's pretty much the Gnostic material there. Any thoughts?
There's lots. I was looking at that. There's lots of, it's not small, is it? There's lots of stuff come out on that. And physicists looking at that, our universe would, which would obviously be everything around us, our whole planet being a simulation. Because you look at the moon, you know, you think, what the hell is that thing? Anyone look at the history of the moon, it's completely bizarre.
You heard of this guy named Crow 777? And he's got a telescope, and he's been, you know, taking pictures of the moon stuff and video. And he found like these waves, and it looked like a hologram that were just kind of like lost its substance. And then it's pretty interesting.
So yeah, all of like Saturn, they all just look bizarre. I mean, I got lots of stuff saved, mainstream stuff, so much. One here is our universe fake. Physicists claim we could be all the playthings of an advanced civilization. Is our whole world merely a simulation? You know? And yeah, a bit much for people to understand, but, you know...
Well, you look at the television picture on
exactly,
TV,
exactly.
And it looks so real. Yeah. You're seeing something that happened halfway around, but all it is pixels on the screen.
On the screen, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You wonder, why isn't there any pictures of the Earth from space? There isn't. I mean, a lot of people say the Earth's flat and you get into all that sort of stuff we don't really know.
Oh, yeah, let me mention something on that. I know at least five people, the near-death experiencers, that actually saw the curvature of the Earth. I mean, for what it's worth.
Yeah, it's strange. I'm still in the middle.
Two of them I know personally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just, but, you know, our whole life is... you know, it's all, you know, if you look at the information that we get of space and what's going on out there and science and stuff, it comes from NASA and, you know, everything that, all the information that we're being fed on this planet is you know, completely, yeah. You know, most likely one big lie. And so you think, well, we're being born and living our entire lives, and we're being kept from not only being our true selves and finding out the meaning of life and who we are, but we're being kept in this bubble and, you know, and we just live and die, and that's it.
And you're born into amnesia. You don't remember.
Exactly.
You know,
but it seems like something's keeping us that way as well, on purpose, with intent, is what I mean. You know, we're being kept that way. Another thing I was looked at was really interesting is experiments being done with children, and they remember their past lives as well, which is really fascinating.
Ian Stevenson wrote a book called, I think, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation.
Yeah.
But in a lot of these near-death experiences, they do come back and they have memories of multiple lives.
I read somewhere kids actually remembered the point before when they actually came into the womb, when they said they were...
Yeah. Pre-birth.
Yeah, when they said they were like almost lined up and waiting. And there's another guy I was reading, he was talking about that, like he had a dream about it where he was like almost going down on an elevator back down to the earth level. Yeah. You know,
that's incredible.
Yeah, this guy says, you know, he had a dream where it was almost like he was being taken down to being, you know, reborn again.
Yeah.
And you just think, geez, you know.
But is it reincarnation or is it recycling? I mean,
that's what like, I mean. It sounds like that. Yeah. You know? But, you know, lots of, you know, children are very susceptible at a young age. And why would they sort of make that up? I mean, people think they've just got a vivid imagination. But sometimes they can do incredible things, or they might say they remember their past lives or their parents. Could be all sorts of things, different types of behavior, even, you know, nightmares, all sorts of things, speaking other languages, many things that they can. But, you know, that's one I have read where they actually remember that point before they went into the womb, where they kind of just fell down into that. So they were somewhere else. So they died and they were somewhere else and then came back. Which is fascinating.
I think you have to look at the stories that are kind of out on the fringes or the outliers of our normal experiences, because they can suggest new ways of looking at what's really going on, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we have to do it. We have to do it, don't we? You know, we have to question. I mean, once we lose that as humans, questioning and sort of research you're doing, when people just sort of don't care anymore and just live to live and die, and, you know, it's a sad thing. I think we have to question absolutely everything around us. I think most people have, you know, to think that the universe... I mean, a lot of people who believe in natural law, you know, who are more inclined to that way of thinking and being, you know, would say, well, you know, the universe is fake, the planet is fake, it's a simulation, it's a projection. You know, it's hard for them to understand that, you know, to come to that. But as you said, we watch TV.
The brand of the heretic or crazy.
It's pretty heavy, it's dense stuff. But as you said, we sit down and we watch TV, you know, every night on these huge screens, and it's a projection into our living room.
I think a lot of people rather believe the beautiful lie than an ugly truth. I mean, they're certainly in a little bit of a denial about it. You know,
it does seem whatever's controlling this planet is when you start to look into transhumanism, they're trying to almost merge us with technology. That's definitely going on. You know,
yeah, and that could put us another layer deeper within this matrix or the labyrinth. You know, your simulation within a simulation within a simulation.
I would be inclined to think now that we are. I would say we're organic. You know, we're flesh and blood and we're spiritual. But if that merging takes place. And it becomes more severe, and we do start to merge with technology. Because I mentioned on the last show, you know, the Oculus goggles that are going to come out, where people are going to put those on, and they're going to go into the simulation world, and they're going to play these games.
I saw some videos on that. It's amazing.
Yeah. I was just talking about it on the last show, and it's unbelievable. And I think they're going to have connections in those goggles where it'll be able to access your nervous system and in your brain, so you can smell and taste and stuff like that, you know, so you'll be able to eat and drink and do things and experience them in the goggles, and you'll be able to experience it like the real world.
Probably what we're doing right now.
Exactly.
You know?
But then you get into dreams, and what is a dream? And then you look at that, but that is an artificial sort of, that's stealing this reality away and putting you into another one, and people are going to live in those goggles, and that's where it gets
strange. We
spend
the third of our lives asleep, laying in bed, dreaming, and we have no idea what's really going on, right? We could be like downloaded the information that you know, the program. We just don't know.
It's crazy, you know. But as we said, when you got young children saying they remembered being someone else, you know, in a past life, it's yeah. You know, it's pretty fascinating stuff that we're not looking at and taking seriously. And it also makes me wonder about psychedelics, you know, things like ayahuasca and DMT and even marijuana, strong cannabis, you know. It makes you think differently. It puts you in a different state, and you wonder, why is it illegal? And why are cigarettes and alcohol and these destructive, way we eat and live our lives and movies and things that aren't any good for us, but they won't let us have access to these psychedelics, you know?
Yeah, I wonder why. I had a reader that wrote in, and he was telling me about these beings that abducted him and took him onto this farm. And I asked him, I go, you know, was this during the DMT experience? And he wrote back and he said, yeah. And so they were like these 8-foot beings, and they're like sort of a cross between hybrid or praying mantis. And so he was thinking it was all just this deep, profound wisdom experience that could help us all. And you know, maybe, but that's a very common thing under DMT. They see these insectoids or reptilian beings.
As again, we say, you wonder if you're just being shown what you want to see. You know, if you yourself are creating that.
Well, these projections, somebody wrote me and they were talking about these, I don't know if you've ever heard of the term, like, I think it's called egregore, or they're like tulpas, and it's like a projection of your own mind where they're like thought forms, and that certainly could factor in. It kind of reminds me of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where it says, like, when you die, there's these different series of lights of different colors that come, and that it's just a projection of your own mind, and to kind of ignore them, and all these different demons will appear, and it is interesting.
I do, yeah. I've got a book on that where I've read into that, where people have very nasty experiences and see demonic entities and all sorts of monsters and things like that. It's really interesting looking at the shadow people as well, because I had direct experience with that growing up. As Garth knows, my family know terribly. Yeah, I had terrible, shocking night terrors. They got out of hand to a spirit. I actually remember having very bad nightmares, just being really young, even maybe 2-3 years old and this sort of thing, you know. But it got really bad in my early teenage years, up until about 17, 18, especially around 15 years old and stuff. I had almost every night. And I had terrible, terrible nightmares. Mostly I wouldn't remember, but I would just scream. But the only fragments I do remember is screaming and waking up, or suddenly waking up and being frozen on the bed and seeing these dark figures, but unable to look straight at them, because when you would look at them, they would shift to the right or left, and it would almost be like a flame. Yeah, and I remember that very, very vividly, and not so much at my window, but always in the room quite near me, that they would just shift to the sides, but they wouldn't come forward too much. Sometimes I remember waking up, they were looking over me. But growing up, I was always sort of interested in werewolves and, you know, Dracula and those sort of things. And I did watch some horror movies and quiet movies I probably shouldn't have watched at that age. And I wonder, it was my vibrational state at that time, and especially being young and full of energy, attracting these things into my room at night, because I was watching that type of material, you know.
Yeah, the stories of the vampires and all that stuff, they seem to come from Sumeria and Babylonia, where these seven spirits, and they would like feast on the blood of the men and stuff like that. So even way back, and then you look at Christianity, and Jesus is saying, drink my blood and eat my body. So all that vampirism has kind of been there throughout history.
It has. I mean, forms. Yeah, in Israel, they practice around the world. They do it in your country as well, where the rabbis circumcise the boys and they drink the blood out of the boy's penis.
Wow.
And yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they do. They're trying to stop it. I know it's happened in New York and places. They're saying it's unhygienic. Mm-hmm. And if you can look that up pretty quickly, but... I know in Israel, where they wail on the wall, they seem to be conjuring up demons. Maybe it's very strange. But you look at war itself; we've always talked about that. Even you know, all the world wars are just with all this blood and death. You know, that you mentioned that this sort of takeover, all this.
It's a huge offering for them. It's a big feast where all that blood's spilling, right?
Yeah. You wonder, in our ancient past, if there was a golden age, if there was a you know, a better way of living and a loving, more spiritual state going on. And there seems like there was some type of intervention, like, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Originally it was peaceful, and then somehow they hijacked the system.
Something came in. But it clearly, as you said, it feeds on this blood. And it's always about that, isn't it? And you look at ritualistic sacrifices right throughout history, you know? And you look at the natives in South American stuff, where they're very brutal in cutting heads off and sacrificing. And you wonder where they get that.
Pyramids, right?
You're on top of the pyramids. It's so amazing. Yeah, it's just
there was these serpent deities in almost every culture.
Exactly.
And they
thought they saw the gods, and you're wondering, what gods you're talking about? I was just looking the other day at some local churches and courthouses, and they've all got pyramids. Even our Parliament House in Canberra, you know, where our politicians are, it's a pyramid as well. You know, it's always with the pyramids, and they sacrifice these people on top of the pyramids, and they claim that they saw these gods that told them to do it and all this, and they want blood, and they're sacrificing to appease and make the gods happy so they would get a good life. And so there's always these gods that wanted blood and death, you know. Yeah, it's very interesting. And then we go back to that fear state that we're kept in very tightly now, from birth to death, you know. I think a lot of people don't realize it, that they're living in a fear state. It's like the layers of an onion, isn't it? You know, and when you die, if you're wrapped in that and you die, I mean, it's going to be hard to maneuver in that afterlife experience. And if you're going to, as we said, if you're going to see beings of light showing you this love, if that is truly indeed technology, which means it's fake, you're going to fall into
that. Well, and the being of light, it could be even like, you know, I was talking about this, there's this being called Lucifer, right? And, you know, it means light bearer, but the dictionary defines Lucifer as Venus. as in Nana, she was called the Queen of Heavens. Okay, and when they say heavens, it's really the counterfeit heavens, right? You know, they're the gods supposedly, but it's their heavens are the astral planes basically. And she had a warlike aspect as Inanna and even as Ishtar and Kali, but as Aphrodite, okay, she was the Greek goddess of desire. And Venus, she's the goddess of beauty and love. And as Lucifer, she was the most beautiful angel or goddess. So NDEers are drawn to the light mostly by their desire to go to it because it's pretty and it's attractive or alluring. And then when it's in their presence, they feel the love of you know, Venus. So you got to wonder about that.
I have heard as well that the actual true light where we really reside, where we're meant to go, is different than the light that we're shown in the near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's a way to tell, but maybe from more highly evolved. I don't know.
The clear light. I don't even know what clear light would be.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's a lot of heavens that aren't real and they're just copies, but they're very, very convincing since they're copies of the real thing. And then when the soul approaches this light, it tricks the soul into thinking it's the real thing, and they've ultimately they've seen the truth when they're part of this universal soul. But ultimately, I think we're just lying in pods somewhere playing a VR computer game of life and controlling these avatars, and it's just computer data telling us what our avatars are perceiving. It's just part of the plot of the game that you wake up and you're prisoners and you escape or overthrow the wardens. I mean, even a couple of the NDEs even alluded to the pods, and it's all being a game or entertainment. And like the movie War Games, it's a strange game. The only winning move is not to play.
It's crazy. Yeah. So you're sort of alluding to the fact there that we're all gods and we're playing this
we have light
simulation
within us.
Game. Yeah.
We have the divinity. We're from source, but you know, and I think as you die, your vibration starts going back higher, and it's like you're reverting back to your original form, your original state, and you're going to learn that you're really the true light. But then they kind of like they dingle this light out there, and before you can make the process complete, they lure you into the false realm again and capture you and send you back down, and you forget everything.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the trick is to not take it so serious and just enjoy it and take charge of your life and you know, at that point of death, try and take charge and know who you are in your way.
Yeah, I believe the focused intent of your willpower is important, and I would avoid using words as language has been manipulated, and so I would use pure imagination or like a mind picture. And for me, it'll be focusing on the light of lights in that eternal light realms, and that the Gnostics, I do trust the Gnostic texts at this point at least, and so you have an escape plan in mind with contingencies, and I don't, you might want to act, you know, it's like a, what do? You like kind of hang around, wait for your light to raise and your truth coming back, or do you, you know, or do you act? I mean, do you want to act quickly and not hang around? Because the light appears within like seconds, or certainly within a minute. And you know, a lot of them do say they're pulled there. I think you're kind of decide to go there, whether consciously or unconsciously. But are you going to take that chance?
Yeah,
you know, I think the soul can build up these, like there's like black goo that's on your soul, and then shamans have even seen this, and it kind of, it's like a residue, and it kind of adds weight, and I think maybe they can even use that to pull you.
That's interesting you mentioned that, because we've talked about that before in other shows, because there was actually, for example, there was a Lady Gaga clip where the whole clip was all this black goo. Have you seen that clip?
I don't think so, no.
I'll have to send that to you. It's for an Italian guy made it. It was for a perfume or something, and it's a long clip, and the whole clip is filled with this kind of black sludge, and it's got like a technology in it. I've seen it in many movies as well, lots of films. You know, it was even in The Matrix a little bit, where it goes down his throat and turns black, but the Lady Gaga and some of them I've seen it in. Yeah, and I've noticed it in a lot of horrors and sci-fis, and I started thinking, what's with this black goo in these movies?
Like the Grudge and all that too.
And you're saying it's like a weight sort of getting in you and weighing you down, but it's obviously a negative
thing. I think it's important to raise your vibrational level and like to live a life, a spiritual life of like altruistic love and to think about truth and God as much as you possibly can. And you know, somebody you can ascend to the highest realms and still be able to stay there. So in order to do that, you want to let go of all your grudges and regrets and jealousies, anger, resentment, and fear. And, you know, that gets rid of that residue and they possibly allowed us to be pulled in without it. And so if you let go of your attachments to the physical plane, like the Buddhists say, you know, the suffering is due to desire, and so you want to become detached to a lot of that. Otherwise, you get so stuck to the. I mean, most people when they die, they're going to be thinking, "Oh wow, I get another chance at life. That's great. You know, I can go back and do better." I mean, you know, don't you think most people will be thrilled with another shot at life? You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I'd be ready to move on though.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I've had enough. Yeah, but I understand what you mean there. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I alluded to before. If, you know, when I was young growing up, you know, looking at negative material, then you start to maybe attract these shadowy people, in these shadowy beings into your life, you know. It really does make sense, mm-hmm. you know, that you need to sort of cast all that aside.
Yeah, there's a website, yourghoststories.com.
So many.
And
yeah.
And there's thousands and thousands of them. I mean, it's just crazy how many stories there are of it.
It's all over the world. I mean, it's just ongoing. Yep. Yeah, it's too incredible to ignore, you know. It's amazing, you know. Well, worth looking into and keep going.
What's that?
Worth keep looking into and keep going, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's so many things out there, and that's just one aspect of it all. But it's an important one.
Anything else?
Because people, you know, these near-death experiences, these meetings, and they talk about the light and love and how beautiful everything is and how great. I mean, you hardly ever, you know, no one mentions the shadow. I mean, somebody did talk about, you know, something that happened to their phone and weird stuff happening, but nobody didn't say anything. Like, oh, that's the shadow beings, and you know, they're either not aware of it or they just don't want to focus on anything negative.
Yeah, 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 that's true.
Like it's not like it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a strange world around us, you know. It really is. It absolutely is, yeah. Well, it's, we might pack it up. Anything else you want to finish on? Anything? You've pretty much got everything.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Adam, and I truly appreciate everything you've done. I mean, I've been sitting on this information for like eight months, and I've been wanting to get it out there, and thank you.
It's definitely worth for people to have a few listens, and there's a lot of information that you went through in there, so it's really important, and, you know, I think people will enjoy it, you know? I think you went through a ton of stuff.
So I hope I didn't get like too much of a religiotard on everyone, but you know it is all tie in together.
I think it all adds up to you know, as you said, as you just
millions and millions and millions of people that have been killed in the name of religion.
Exactly. And, yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And most of it's based on false. I mean, they didn't even like the Bible, the Old Testament. It's all the stories are borrowed from, you know, Babylonian or Sumerian or different. I mean. It can pretty much be proven, you know.
It absolutely seems that there's something on this planet that's desperate to keep us asleep and does not want to be us to discover this sort of stuff, you know. Wants to just keep it going at any means necessary, you know.
When somebody suggested that I asked somebody, you know, talk to the people that have had near-death experiences what they think of my theory, and I thought, okay, that's fair. So I'll go to their meetings. I really thought I was going to walk into like a lion's den or whatever. But when I started researching the near-death experiences, it only made me more confident in the theory. I mean, people saying that it's a game and that there, you know, it's a simulation, and that there's they saw the face of God and it was a lion's face, you know. I mean, and they're just shape shifting. I mean, granted, these are not the normal. I mean, it's not like 50% of the experiences, but if there's two or three dozen that are saying that, I think that's a significant number.
It is, absolutely. Yeah, you can't discount all these experiences. It's just too overwhelming. It needs to be, but it's not looked at, you know. It's not looked at and not taken serious, you know. The mainstream media doesn't want anything to do with it. You have to do a bit of digging and do stuff like this to...
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they let me present to the group. I mean, it is a little... That's the thing, people consider it negative, but really it's positive because you're trying to expose the fraud that's going on. Isn't that positive?
We do. We view death as a negative thing in this life because we fear it, you know. And some, you know, that's what people do. They fear death. You know, one of the greatest fears of most people is being buried alive, because when someone dies, they still associate, you know, the person's being still being in their body and being lowered into the ground when it's just a body, you know. That's why they fear it so much, you know. And there's even a lot of people that, you know, don't want their young kids to go and see their grandparents in retirement homes because they think it's negative, you know.
My grandma died a few months ago, and she didn't want to die alone, so I took time off at work to be with her. Then my parents sent her to hospice because the doctor said she only had a couple of weeks at the most to live, two or three days or 2 weeks. So I said, I'll stay with you, Grandma, since you want to die alone. And she was talking to the things that were not there, and I asked the hospice. She'd been working there 30 years, and I said, do you ever see these light orbs? And she's like, yeah. And I go, you ever see these shadow beings? She's like, yeah. And she says, oh, they get visitors. They come all the time. And as a matter of fact, I was there, like, it was toward the end of the week, and I was pretty tired. I wasn't sleeping. And I felt something try to pull me out of my body. I felt this tugging on my leg. And then she was... One time they were like asking her what her name was, and she said, oh, I'm Dorothy Saunders, and she told them what her birth date was, and then she's like, oh, that's my son Wayne, and you know, it's like they didn't know who she was, or they're just verifying, like they're coming for the body. I mean, it was interesting to watch.
See that? Yeah, it's incredible, and they'll point right through you, they'll look at you through you, they'll mention names. It's like they're getting ready, and they're starting to see
this
other world.
Yeah, why didn't even know her birth date, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah.
It really
is. Yeah. I've had direct experiences with sort of ghosts as well in the family.
Yeah, she told me she saw the Grim Reaper like several times in her life. And not like right before she died, but she saw glimpses of it too. And I saw a shadow being in a photograph of my ex-girlfriend's sister. And I'm like, what is that? And it's like this big shadow being like 8 feet tall standing right next to her sister.
Attached.
It's oh, yeah. Probably.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Well, we go back to it, yeah, if they're keeping us negative and keeping us in a fear state and angry and confused and a constant state of war, life after life, you know, then these things would be obviously having a feeding frenzy, you know, and weighing us down.
It's a Star Trek episode, I think it's called Day of the Dove, and they're like inciting Captain Kirk to fight with the Klingons, and there's this little orb of light that's like, you know, hovering above them, and as they're fighting, it's like gaining energy and turning colors, and finally, somehow Captain Kirk realizes there's this entity up there, and he's like, you know, we're feeding them, we got to stop this, and...
It's crazy. I really do think it is all about love, you know. I don't know what this light is at the end of the tunnel after death, but I think while we're on this planet, it is all about that, you know, actual, unconditional, true love.
Suffer?
Yeah, and
do people
doing
need to
good
suffer
stuff.
For us to love?
Yeah, helping, and you know? I think it is all about that, you know, and being the best person you can be, and just trying to be positive, and not let things get you down, and not get negative, and not think negative thoughts. You know, which is hard, very, very hard. I understand it's hard for anybody. Yeah, it's constantly being pumped out, but you got to try. You know, I think that's.
I've been on this positivity kick where I like created playlists that's only positive music,
exactly.
And
yeah, you can.
You know,
do
it's
it.
Not easy doing the research I'm doing. I kind of take it on the chin for the masses. I do try to stay positive and balanced, and from times throughout the day, you know, so. It's important.
Yeah, that voice tells you, you know, if you're out there, you're in the car and someone cuts you off, or you get angry and you yell. Yeah, that voice says no, you know. You can just chill out.
I'm almost scared when I'm driving. I switch lanes on a freeway because I know, you know, they're just baiting me. They're just trying to get me one way or another, but I'm super careful.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of energy vampires all around the place, you know, like people at your work or wherever it may be that are always trying to bait you and bait people and make you angry.
Your buttons. Try to even consciously
push your buttons.
Into the conversation, you're going, I'm not going to get mad, and they're just like pushing your butt. It's like they're controlled by a demon.
And then you get angry and they're happy, and then you go to bed all angry and tired, and they go off and all happy and excited, you know, draining people. I see them everywhere. Yeah, always trying to bait people and make them upset, you know, and they get off on it, you know. It's crazy. You can't let it happen, you know. Absolutely not.
Like you said, to, you know, just center your mind and with inner silence and not react to it. Because only when you react, you're just feeding them. You know?
Exactly.
You don't go find a better meal somewhere else.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Go and eat somewhere else.
Yep.
All right. All right, we'll plug out. Very good show. Very interesting. And put this up today and send it to you, of course. And I hope your talk goes well.
Are
you going to record that? Or?
I don't know.
Hmm.
I think I just did.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. We could. Yeah, pretty much. Right. It's the same sort of thing you're gonna do.
For the most part.
Yeah.
Not be as heavy-handed. I'll be a little more considerate of, you know, because those are sacred experiences to them. But at the same point, I want the information to be at least known so they can evaluate it for themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, good stuff. And all right, so Tricked by the Light is your great website, and plenty to look at there. Anything else you want to plug before we go?
No.
That's it?
No, just good night, sleep tight, and don't let the Archons bite.
Yeah, well, I won't. No, I won't do that anymore. I've had enough of that, mate.
Exactly.
Had enough of the spooks in the night.
Well, thanks again, Adam. Anytime, I'm always available for you to come on your show.
Yeah, good. Always good with this type of material that you're doing, Wayne, to every few months to sort of catch in with you.
And I thought about just coming it off and talking off the top of my head and winging it, and I'm sure I do an okay job, but I think it's really important to give the quotes, because people could just say, well, he's making it up, or he's, you know, taking it out of context. But with actual quotes, I mean...
Yeah, it's amazing. That's what I said. It would take years to go through all that and try and put it all together, but you're putting it all in one presentation, and it's all actual real quotes from people who have had NDEs, you know?
My friend and colleague Chris Hall, he did almost all of the Sumerian texts and Gnostic texts. Every night he's sending me all these quotes from ancient texts, and he does just an amazing job. And I don't know that I could do that myself. It's just thousands of pages, and all these names are just swimming in it, you know.
Yeah,
but he can get right through the nonsense somehow.
Though. It's good. I've got some Gnostic books, but they're hard to get through, and they're pretty dry,
yeah,
and they're big reads, but it's good to keep learning, and with the work that you're doing, it's always changing and shifting, so it's good to catch up every now and then and pinpoint where you're at and get some more info out, you know,
and go over
the stuff we've done, of course, but all adds up, so nice work.
Yeah, and I tried not to cover the same stuff that I did on the first show.
It's good. Lots of this. Yeah, that was really good. Lots of stuff in there for people to mull over, have a think about.
Yeah, sure.
Chill out and relax.
Website's just getting out of hand. It's just this big sprawling octopus, and I just keep adding to it all the time. And I don't have the time to sit there and go through it and rewrite it. And maybe in a year or two when I retire. But so it's good to come on a show like this, and I can give people a concise, you know, hour or two of the most pertinent stuff.
And thank you for that. So thanks a lot, buddy. So it was very good and very much appreciated.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate your generosity. And you don't even say, you know, here's what I want you to talk about. You don't say, well, I don't want you to talk about it. It's just whatever I want to talk about, I come on and you're good with it. So
no, I know. I never censor anybody. Anybody that comes on my podcast as a guest are free to say whatever they want to say. I don't cut anything out. I put it straight up, you know. That's
great,
what it's about. I never tell anybody to say or not say anything. Ever. That's the way it goes.
I don't know. That's a good, definitely good thing.
All right, we'll plug out for today. Great show. And I'll put this up. It's going to be a popular one. The last one was. Got some great comments on the site, even saying get Wayne back on, the show, and got a lot of great emails.
I know if you put it up on YouTube, there's always going to be people that are just going to attack it because, you know, like I said, you're talking about an ugly truth, and people just, and you know, you go on and you talk for 2-3 hours and you give like 3,000 data points, and you may make a mistake on 2 or 3. I mean, I've been wrong before, and those will be the ones they say, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about, you know, blah blah blah. And it's like, why are people so negative?
I'll put this one up on YouTube then. I've got a YouTube channel. I'll whack it up.
Oh, okay.
Pictures or
we'll
something.
See how the reactions are.
Okay.
I don't mind. I'm not even going to read that stuff.
That's right.
I put it out there, and if a few people get benefit from it, then that's like I say, I'm coming here, I'm taking as many souls back as I can, you know, and the people don't want to, they don't, you know, they got their own opinions, and that's fine.
No, I'm in, man. I'm in.
I don't know for sure that I'm right, you know, and I want to say that. I don't claim to know the truth. It's just what I've found.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. All right, buddy. We'll tune out and chat again soon.